Tonight on The Download, writer, poet, and the co-creator of Brown Girls, Fatima Askar, stand-up comedian Hari Kondabolu, and live music from John Langford and the Four Lost Souls. Now, here's your host, a man who is dressing up as Harley Bruce Rauner for Halloween, Justin Kaufman.
That's got to be a popular costume, right? That's my only concern. Harley Bruce Rauner, I feel like everybody's going to be doing it, right? So it'll just be cliche by this point. If I were going to go as a state lawmaker, I would go as Judy Bartopinka. I know, you know, the late Judy Bartopinka, but she was just so outstanding. That would be a great Halloween costume. But Harley Bruce Rauner, second, right? You can't do regular Bruce Rauner. But I think if you were able to get that vest, find that vest, you know.
I find that the worst Halloween costumes are the thought pieces.
I'm a peanut butter jelly. Get it? No, I don't get it.
Yeah.
I'm Obamacare. All right, now, don't. Please. It's so true, man. It's so true. Although I feel like that would be something I want to do this year. My son wants to go as one of the Harry Potter characters, which is great because he's reading the books. He wants to go as one of the villains, like Malfoy, Draco Malfoy. And I'm like, really? You know how many Draco Malfoys I see at the dumb bar when I'm at the map room for the Halloween party? It's hard when you have a 10-year-old because you're like, that those books came out 10 years ago or whatever. More than that, right? 15 years ago, 20 years ago? So I'm always like, it's been done. Dad, you could be Voldemort. Nah, I've seen that one too. Like, I become so much more about how fresh it can be, you know? For 15 years of my life, longer, I just went as Dracula. I got a thing of teeth from Walgreens and a cape.
Classic.
Wore my same clothes. I'm like, they're like, who are you? I'm Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
It was good. So.
So you dress up, you're dressing up for Halloween when you go out trick-or-treating.
I'm taking the day. I'm not going to be here on Tuesday, Halloween night. There's no Blackhawks game, but I'm taking the night off because it's a big deal for a family to do Halloween.
Yeah, of course.
And there's a ton of trick-or-treating in the neighborhood. And so, yeah, we go as a whole family unit. So, and my wife was on the phone with Amazon today fighting because her shipment of the snake costume, there's a snake in Harry Potter.
Uh-huh.
And she was going to go as it. She bought it off of Amazon. I don't know the name of the snake. I should be paying more attention. And it didn't show up, so she forwarded me the chat with the Amazon, you know, bot, where she's just yelling, where's my snake?
Yeah. You know? Hey, Siri, we're coming up. It's crunch time.
She was mad because it says it was delivered and it wasn't there.
Yeah.
So there you go. All right, this is a download. It's just Justin Kaufman here, 720 WGN, with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We got an awesome show lined up tonight. I'm so excited. Got a bonus download in Chicago business. Doug Cook's going to be here. He is the man, the owner and president of Feldco. You hear the commercials here on WGN, and we're going to talk with him about the window siding and door company that's been a part of Chicagoland for 40 years. My guest coming up at the Download in Chicago Business. How do you expand? How do you keep it fresh? How do you look forward to the next 40 years? Coming up at the big table tonight, I'm so excited. Fatima Askar, she's a great poet, educator, performance artist. She's also a television producer. Her great web series Brown Girls was picked up by HBO, so want to nominate for an Emmy just coming up here. So Fatima coming on the show. It's been a while. We had a couple of because of hockey and baseball and other things. We've been trying to schedule to have her in. I'm very excited to have her here. Big fan of her work. So awesome to have her at the big table tonight, 8 o'clock. Coming up at 9 o'clock, as I mentioned with Ro, Hari Kondabolu is back. The stand-up comedian will be here. We'll talk with him about not only a show at the Hideout this weekend, but he's also got a new documentary on True TV called The Problem with Apu. Talked about a little bit in the crosstalk, but also just the idea that the many South Asian comics, writers in Hollywood are in this documentary scratching their head about the characterization of Apu on The Simpsons, 28 years of that character that runs the Quickie Mart, the Indian cartoon. And they look at it and they say it's offensive. It's not any different than the minstrel shows of the early vaudeville. There's something there. Played by a white guy, Hank Azaria is great. It's great. Everyone loves Hank, but at the same time, it's a white guy playing an Indian Quickie Mart owner. So we'll talk with Hurry about that. Plus, John Langford and Four Lost Souls. How great. You're going to be talking about Muscle Shoals, brand new record, and they're going to be playing live in studio. Big show tonight. Very excited. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Roger Badish. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll come back. We'll do the carry out. Stay with us. All right, it's Download here, 720 WGN. Let's carry out. Here today is top stories. The Illinois House rejected the bump stock ban today, although the headlines are a little deceiving. Yes, this bill would have banned the accessories that make semi-automatic weapons automatic, but the bill went further, going after magazine sizes, explosives for target practice, and other accoutrements that would be put law-abiding gun owners in a pickle, making them criminals instantly. Although that's all about interpretation. But that's how the gun lobby spun it in Springfield, and it has been denied. And the cynics are out saying that this legislation was never designed to pass the House. It was just designed to get everyone on record for the upcoming election year. Now you can comfortably say this candidate voted against gun control and go all black and white and frayed. Maybe a stamp, some prison bars, sound of an Uzi. I mean, full-fledged, like all the stops. Pay for all the sound effects you can for the attack ad. Top of the line. There's a GOP version that could be considered this bill, but the House and GOP versions don't ever get considered. So, no, that's never going to happen. President Trump declared a federal emergency over the opioid crisis. This could give agencies authority to use monies to fight the epidemic that's killing thousands of people in this country. But I'm confused a little bit. And it could easily be that I'm lazy and ignorant, don't know how to use Google. But when we're talking about opioids, we're talking about heroin and pain pills, right? And heroin's way more of an issue than the latter. So did heroin just get rebranded? Is that what's happening here? Is opioid just heroin, but just easier to sell to middle-class America? Or has there been a rush on other drugs that fit the classification, like fentanyl? I've seen a lot on fentanyl, which also is an injected. It just seems to me that heroin addiction is a real thing in our area. Just look at DuPage County, and we never say it. It's like some pollster came in and said, nope, you know what? Heroin's out, opioid's in. And use a hashtag. Everybody loves hashtags. So I have my popcorn and Twizzlers. I cleared a few hours off the schedule tonight. I'm ready to pour over the JFK documents that the president promised to release today. He went to Twitter. He told us it was coming. I'm so excited. I'm so excited. What? Today, Trump delayed the more sensitive documents because of concerns from the intelligence community. So what do I do with these Twizzlers now? In the next 2 hours of the show, who cares? I guess we'll just talk about Twizzlers. I would do that. George H.W. Bush, the former president, being accused of groping two women while he was in a wheelchair. He doesn't deny it either, instead saying that the groping was done to make the women feel at ease. That's a direct quote. Because there's nothing that puts a human being at ease than another human being smacking their rear end, right? Or is that why they do it in sports? You look uneasy. And they slap you in the butt. Learn something new about the old creepers every day. I guess he would grab a behind and he would say, you know who's my favorite magician? David Copperfield. That's true. Like, that's true. Now, you would expect that humor from another Bush president. But H-Dub? This is changing my whole worldview on this dude. In weather, nice and crisp today, like a fresh pumpkin. But rain on the way, so that pumpkin's going to get moldy and mushy before it's all over. And that is Chicago weather. I just explained it to you, right? How about that? In sports, the Bulls are back in the court tonight, taking on the Atlanta Hawks. The Bulls are one of two teams that hasn't found a win yet. The Bulls and the New York Knickerbockers, both winless. The Hawks are 1-3 and in dead last in the Southeast. So maybe this could be the night that they get into the winning column at the UC, already underway, wearing their red away jerseys. When they played Cleveland the other night, they wore their home whites. While in Cleveland, I don't know, right there, fix that, maybe we get a win. The basketball gods are like, nah, you can't wear red at home. It's kind of weird, too, because, you know, if you're watching the game, the United Center, the paint in the paint is red. So when any of the Bulls get into the paint, they disappear. Their bodies disappear. It's like a green screen. It's like a red screen. It's funny. More coaching changes for the Cubs. Third base coach Gary Jones is out. This seems to be the right move, only because many expert Cub fans have had problems with the way Jones handled base runners. And let's be honest, have you ever seen a game where two guys were on the same base at the same time in a playoff game? Remember that? Just a week ago or so? I mean, it's ultimately on the players, but the third base coach definitely has something to do with it. It's embarrassing. Also, get me a more splashy third base coach. Lots of cool windmill-like hand and arm gestures. That's what I want to see. How about Joe Girardi? He's out at the Yankees head coach. Put him over at third. Or White Sox. Feel bad for Rick Renteria. Every time a high-end coach comes available, we're like, Sox! They have a coach. Oh. Best news of the day, though, Chili Davis is the new hitting coach for the Chicago Cubs. Yes, the Chili Davis. Arguably one of the best 80s baseball names of all time. Right up there with Candy Maldonado and Buddy Biancalana. Chili Davis is on the Cubs coaching staff. I'm beside myself. How great is it?
You know, you could tell right away that the hitters are really learning from Chili Davis.
It rolls off the tongue. Chili Davis. Cubs coach. Love it. World Series was pretty awesome last night. I mean, I missed it because I was watching Lonzo Ball, John Wall showdown. So hyped for nothing for two players who really don't matter at the beginning of the regular season. But if you just went by what ESPN said, you'd think it would be Magic Bird. Nah. Anyway, good World Series game as the Astros won an extra inning. Now three games straight in Houston. Could get interesting. Yeah, I don't care. Big weekend for college football. Big game for the Cats as they take on Michigan State. A win on Saturday could go a long way for bowl game consideration. And Notre Dame, currently the number 9 team, will take on North Carolina State. Big showdown that will have playoff, BCS playoff repercussions. I just like when Notre Dame loses so I can see that coach blow a gasket. He reminds me of the guys who ran the general merchandise department when I was a teenager working at the local grocery store. Nice haircut, nice disposition with the customers there. But when you get behind the big flappy doors, just nonstop yelling, face getting all red. I mean, that's essentially Coach Kelly, right? And nailed it. And finally tonight, a new study says that 80% of baby formula contains arsenic. What? I mean, arsenic has been known to affect humans' motor skills, so I guess that explains why babies are blabbering all the time, right? We thought it was baby talk, but it turns out it's arsenic, right? Next, you're going to tell me that babies can use a toilet. They just don't want to. It's the arsenic. All right, that's the carryout for October 26, 2017. Speaking of arsenic, if you developed a taste for the chemical, you're in luck. We got a special on charcoaled arsenic with a side of broccoli. Hey, you got to keep it healthy, right? All right, coming up, we got a special download on Chicago business with the owner and president of Feldco. And we'll talk about, they just celebrated 40 years in the Chicago area. We'll talk about what they have to do to plan for 40 more. And also Fatima Osgert, the poet, performing artist, and television producer with us at the big table. It's Download. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
You were mentioning fun baseball names.
Yeah.
Remember, there were two Mookies.
That's right.
Wilson and Betts.
Betts is, he's too new school for me. Wilson was always the only Mookie I know.
Yeah.
It was Mookie Wilson. Leadoff
cool
hitter for the, yeah, right. Just on that, if not mistaken, the 84 Mets, right? And then he went on in 85 and 86.
That sounds about right.
Because I remember they were like, the Mets were the team that the Cubs had to beat in 84, and Mookie Wilson was the leadoff guy, and Keith Hernandez was on that team, the whole bet.
Good stuff.
Blah.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. It's business time. It's business. It's business time. I don't know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time. Ooh. Yes, it's time for the download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. It's our weekly segment that features interviews with Chicago area CEOs and entrepreneurs. They share their stories so we can better understand ours. Tonight, my guest is the owner and president of one of the more recognizable local companies, just based on their jingle, Feldco. Doug Cook took over the reins of the Midwest's largest window, siding, and door company back in 2000. Feldco's been in business since 1976. It's located in Des Plaines, but it's recently branched out and expanded the business with purchases of Danley's Garage World or Early Time Home Solutions, just to name a few. Feldco employs over 450 people, operates out of 8 locations in the Midwest, and claims over $50 million in annual revenue. and it's continually cited as one of the best workplaces in the Midwest. Doug Cook, welcome to the Download in Chicago Business.
It's great to be here, Justin. Thanks for having me.
So you're an entrepreneur. You're a guy who came in 2000, said, I want to get involved in business, and you purchased Felco. Talk about that.
I did. I'm a born and bred Chicago guy. Having grown up here, going to school around here, University of Illinois, I got my start in business working in broadcasting, and I worked for ABC, and I sold airtime around the country, and it was in the early 90s, and I was having a great time. It was showbiz, bright lights, big city,
the prime time of broadcasting, the early 90s, right?
Exactly, and I was looking to say, you know, what do I do when I grow up, kind of thing, and so it was at that point in my life I went back to grad school and I decided to get my MBA to learn a little bit more about business and be a little bit more of a well-rounded professional. So I stayed in broadcasting and did my evening studies at Northwestern here and earned my MBA. It was during that period at Northwestern that I was able to expose myself to a lot of different aspects of business, and there was nothing more electrifying for me than entrepreneurship. When I got to sit in classes teaching entrepreneurship and studying entrepreneurship at a master's level, it really connected me with something that, you know, I was listening to myself said, this is what you need
to
do.
Well, I always think about it. There's two kind of entrepreneurs. There's the one that's going to want to start up. Mm-hmm. And we see it a lot in Chicago where they say, I've got an idea for a business and I'm going to build it from the ground up.
Absolutely.
And there's others that come in and acquire. Mm-hmm. And in your case, you acquired. You went in looking for businesses that already were up and running.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I didn't have a partner. I didn't have an idea, you know, to go and start something up. I'd made a few bucks in real estate from an investment I'd made back, you know, a few years before that. And I was single. I figured, you know what, if something goes south here, I'll go and live in a refrigerator box somewhere. But fortunately, that's never come to pass. But the fact was that I didn't have that partner. I didn't have that idea. And I figured, you know what, if you're not going to start it, you're not going to partner on it, go and try and acquire something. And there was a lot of different things that I went and looked at, specifically after I finished my studies at Northwestern. I took 2 years and I looked at well over 150 different businesses.
What was attractive about Felco? Because at this point, I mean, 2000, you're talking about a company that's been around for 25 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, the gentleman, Mr. Feld, Feldco, it's in his name.
Absolutely.
What was attractive about this company?
Well, first of all, it was a window siding and door company that did a little bit more, you know, some other types of home improvement projects, roofing, fencing, patio work, and so forth. What really appealed to me about the business itself was when I stripped away the fact of it may have been a construction company, it was really a sales and marketing organization that I thought fit my background and my skill set exceptionally well. The fact that it was a business that I always tell people was dusty, it wasn't rusty, it just needed some reinvigoration. The gentleman, Bernie Feld, the founder of the company, was looking to retire. He didn't have anybody to go sell the company to, didn't have anybody to pass the business off to. His children weren't really interested in running it, so he had to put the business for sale. And we had the great fortune of meeting each other. We clicked with each other, and it took 6 months or so to work a deal out. But it was a terrific relationship, and of all the great people I've met in my professional career, he's right up there with one of the best of them.
When you acquire a company like that, and you go after a company that's already been around for 25 years, as you said, dusty, not rusty, but a lot of now you're taking over as the leader, you're the president, you're the owner. You want to change the culture. You want to change whatever you want to change. How difficult is that when the company's had employees that have been there for a long time that they know it a certain way? How difficult is it to come in and try to change the environment?
Right. Simply put, it's their home turf, right? I'm the visitor on their playing field. So somehow I had to go from being the visitor to kind of being the coach, right? And that just comes with time. You've got to earn people's trust. You've got to work with people. You got to get into the trenches with them, roll up your sleeves, learn what they do, why they do what they do, and all those kinds of things. So when it does come time to start transforming things and changing things, you need to understand, you need to empathize with people. You need to explain where you're going and why you're going there and why this is good for them. And so a lot of coaching, a lot of training along the way. But it took time and patience. And I tell people that, you know, the first time I did it, it took a lot longer than the subsequent times I've done it and bought other companies. You know, there's a learning curve and it's rooted around people. And that's the essence of what we as an organization are about. We're an organization of people serving people. And you've got to make sure our people, our staff, connect with the people they're serving. I want our staff to represent the communities they serve. I want them to look like the communities they serve. I want them to talk like the communities they serve, because we're their neighbors. Mm-hmm. We're just as much of a part of this community or any community we serve. And that's just something I learned very early on when I walked into Feldco 17 years ago. It's about the people, plain and simple.
When you are coming in and you have different goals. You know, you want to take Feldco somewhere else, you want to expand it, you want to make it more profitable, whatever you want to do, whatever the generic goals are. How do you set about doing that? Is that as someone who comes into you, say, these are my goals to everybody who's in the room, everybody come into the cafeteria, let's talk, mm-hmm. these are my goals. Or is it something that you try to organically work with the company that you have, the management that's already in place, the people who are actually doing the work on the ground? Talk about that process of realigning goals with a staff that may have wanted to do something else a week before.
Well, I think you have to be very subjective about it, number one. I've done this well over 5 or 6 times now, and every time is a little different because every organization is comprised of different people and no two people are alike. So you have to have your beliefs, and you have to have your style, your system that you want to implement, let's say. But in order for that system or processes to work properly, you've got to get people to operate within them, and you've got to have people believe in them. So in some cases, it's cajoling, it's explaining, it's coaching. In other cases, it turns to discipline. It really varies. It's across the realm of possibilities of what you have to deal with, because it's ultimately back to that word people.
Doug Cook is the president and owner of Feldco. He's my guest tonight on the Download in Chicago Business. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation with Doug here on the Download in Chicago Business. Stay with us.
It's business time.
In studio tonight, Doug Cook. He is the president and owner of Feldco, the windows, sidings, and door company. We all know the jingle. He is in studio tonight on the Download in Chicago Business talking about his time, 17 years at the company. The company just turned 40 last year, which is amazing. Started in 1976. As the leader of this company now, what do you have to do to think about the next 40 years? I mean, where are you? I mean, is the idea to sustain the business that you're doing? Do you have grandiose ideas to say that we're going to expand window, siding, and door for the next 40?
Well, we've over the last 10 years, we've expanded expanded our operations outside of Chicago, originally going into Rockford and then Milwaukee, Quad Cities, Green Bay, Madison, Peoria. So we serve 7 different markets now with 8 different locations. And what we've continuously tried to do is get better at the basics. I'm a big believer in keeping it simple. As I alluded to earlier, we used to do a lot of different types of home renewal work beyond the 3 simple things that I believe in, which are windows, siding, and doors. We live in a world of specialties.
Yeah, right.
You know, you go to the big box stores that specialize in pets or pet products or hardware products or liquor or whatever it may be. Everybody tends to specialize in medicine. Everybody's a specialist in a particular form of medicine. We are specialists with windows, siding, and doors, and we find that there are a ton of people out there across the Fruited Plains that need those products.
Well, I always wonder, because it ultimately falls into the category of home improvement, and we've seen that area, that category of business just explode. The Absolutely. Interest from television, from magazines, from media, it's just all about people are just becoming more and more sophisticated about what they want, what they desire when it comes to their homes.
Mm-hmm.
Has that changed the way you deal with customers, the way that they're coming in much more educated than they have in the past?
Absolutely. For beginners, what our operating philosophy is that someone's home is their single largest asset. It's where their family is. It's where their most important assets in life are, and they want to protect their home and family. Our products do just that. So going in with that thought that you have a product that people want and need for their largest asset, we always want to make sure we have the best products in terms of innovation and technology that are keeping people's
right.
homes cooler in the summer, warmer in the winter. And so whether they're doors, they have the best you know, hottest technology, whether it's a fiberglass or steel or whatever sort of new products are coming out. We want to make sure we're right on the edge there in terms of offering customers what they want when they want it, along the lines of being able to provide customers, you know, the amount of information that they need in this world we live and operate in today. You've got to be professional. You've got to you know, be respectful of people's time. People's time is short, and you've got to give them what they want. They clearly are calling us up, and they want us to come out and you know, give them an assessment of what they need, and they want to do it efficiently. They want to do it professionally. So you have to have people that are well trained and educated in our products and services, and in the competitive landscape. So is that if someone's shopping the environment, they need to know what our competitors are going at us with.
You know, knowing that you've expanded into other markets, this is Milwaukee, Madison, or Green Bay, as you mentioned. You know, for you as a leader, as a CEO, or as a president and owner of the company, I mean, what are the challenges for that? I mean, when I think about the idea, everything you just said about wanting to know exactly what you want to get, keep it simple. You want your people to respect the customer. But as the company gets bigger and bigger and wider and further and farther away, what are the challenges for you as a president to make sure that those things you just mentioned are getting done?
Information. Information is knowledge. Knowledge is power. So along those lines, we are voracious consumers of data about our consumers, about our operations, about all kinds of things going on in and around our organization. So as we spread out from beyond Chicago and we have, you know, 7 or 6 different markets that we're serving, we have a lot of data, both externally and internally, that we are continuously processing to analyze and make sure that we're going about things properly and efficiently, and ultimately that customers are being satisfied. And we don't work, I shouldn't say satisfied, we work with a term at Feltco called customer delight. We don't just want customers satisfied, we want customers delighted, because we realize there are single largest evangelists out there. You want the customer that feels real good about our products and services to go out there and tell their friends, their family, their neighbors, so is that they too will be customers. And so it's kind of like a snowball that's going downhill. You want it to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and we have more and more customers. So today we want to have, or I should say, you know, 10 years out, we want to have 10 times as many customers as we have today.
When you have markets that are varied, rural, suburban, urban, does a customer's wants change? Do their needs change in the way that you have to be prepared to service them in customized different ways?
Well, in this construction space, home renewal project space, you've got to make sure that you have products and services appropriate for your customer and the geography in which they live. It just so happens that all the markets that we serve are fairly similar. They're all upper Midwest markets.
Yeah,
you know,
right,
some may be a little colder than others, they're generally upper Midwest markets. The products and services that we sell are all appropriate for this geography. These products and services would not necessarily be appropriate for the Southwest, where you may have more heat intense products that you need to address, or the Southeast rather, where you're going to have, you know, hurricane strength glass and all those kinds of things. So we do have products that are specifically engineered for our geography, and so that's a big part of what we do. And so we want to have that simplicity, that consistency, that regardless of whether we're in the downtown area of Chicago or out in the farm fields of Wisconsin, our products are right for the consumers that we serve.
My last question quickly just is about the culture in the workplace. You have been cited by a lot of places saying you have one of the stronger workplaces in the Midwest. You get on the lists every year. You have different lists that come out. What's the secret? What is the secret from you as a leader, as an owner of a company, to maintaining a culture that is satisfactory to the employees that work there?
We are extremely, extremely diligent in recruiting to make sure that we put square pegs in square holes and not the other way around. So we want to make sure that we have the right people in our organization that are going to be in line with our thinking and our operating philosophies. So we want to make sure that's the Jim Collins good to great thing. You want to get the right people on the bus in the right seats. And also never, ever forget, it's about the people. We like to work hard, but also like to have fun. So people that are inclined to not have a problem with rolling up their sleeves and diving into the mess of satisfying and delighting customers, we're all about it. And if they can have a good time doing it, it's even better.
Doug Cook is the president and owner of Feldco, the window, sidings, and door company here that serves the Midwest, 8 locations in 8 different places in the Midwest. employs over 450 people and claims over $50 million in annual revenue. My guest at Download Chicago Business. Doug, thanks for being here.
Great to be here. Thanks, Justin.
Hey, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Hori Kondabolu is going to join us, stand-up comedian, who has a new documentary that's on True TV called The Problem with Apu, which is the character on The Simpsons played by Hank Azaria. He talks to several South Asian comedians and writers about what their thought about this character that has been on the show for 28 years. It's amazing that The Simpsons has been on for 28 years. Hori Kondabolu is coming to the Hideout on Sunday for a show. So we'll talk with him coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. And John Langford and his new band, The Four Lost Souls, will be in at 10 o'clock. John Langford, the great singer-songwriter who was the Mekons, a staple at the Hideout here in town, he and Tawny Newsom and Bethany Thomas and John Szymanski, The Four Lost Souls, they went to Muscle Shoals, Alabama. And they did it as almost like a pilgrimage because that town has created some of the best soul, R&B, rock and roll music that this country's ever seen, just about an hour, maybe 45 minutes south of Nashville. And so they wrote all this music and they went and recorded it in Muscle Shoals. And so we're going to talk about the experience here, some of the music. So that's coming up in the 10 o'clock hour tonight. Well, my guest at the big table is a Chicago poet, writer, and now television producer. So excited. Fatima Oscar is one of the women behind the Chicago web series Brown Girls, which was just picked up by HBO. It's a great series that follows two women of color, created by two women of color. Fatima is a well-known name in the Chicago poetry scene. She was awarded a 2017 fellowship with the Poetry Foundation, a Lilly Fellow. She's also been a teaching artist at the Young Chicago Authors and has a new collection of poetry called If They Come For Us, which will be out soon, Random House. Her work is informed by issues of identity and language, and pushing back against the stereotypes and lazy narratives that we use in the world around us. I mean, who better to understand the world than a Pakistani, Kashmiri, Muslim, American, queer woman? Did I mention Chicagoan in there? Fatima is currently developing the Emmy-nominated Brown Girls for HBO, the web series that our buddy Sonia Denise starred in. We had her back on the show when it debuted. Fatima Oscar is one of the best poets working in Chicago today, and she is my guest at the big table. Fatima, thanks for being here. Good to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see you. Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's talk Brown Girls. This is really exciting. When we saw the news come out, we're like, yes, because I feel like, you know, we were early on with Sonia. We were excited about it. It was a great web series. Talk about how this came about. I mean, because it was a web series, and it was Elle Magazine and other places that put it up on the site. But how does it get from that to HBO?
Yeah, I mean, so when I first wrote the web series, it really was written for my community. I didn't think anybody would watch it beyond my friends. Like, I was kind of envisioning a show that my friends would sit around and laugh to. And then Sam Bailey, who is my co-creator and director, came on board to direct it. And Sam had made other web series in Chicago called You're So Talented.
Right.
But I was really, really excited to be working with her. And again, it was very indie, everything we did. Our budget was $20,000. We were kind of really, really bootstrapping everything there. And I really, you know, there was no way in my wildest dreams that I think that we would be where we are right now. But kind of as soon as we dropped the trailer, we noticed this buzz around it. And when we dropped the trailer, it was through like a lot of our friends, like their local media outlets.
Right.
Like one of the first people to write about us was a blog called Black Nerd Problems, which is run by poets. And so they you know, flagged it up, and then it kind of got picked up to bigger places like Elle and Time and people who were writing about us. And then we got a lot of interest in it and went out and pitched it, and HBO was really, really excited about it. And so it kind of happened very, very quickly. Like, this all happened within, you know, a year and some change. And so that to be the timeline of this production is pretty astounding.
Well, I mean, you live such an artistic life, because you're a poet, you're an educator, you're a performer, you're also a screenwriter. But in this case, I mean, you're creating a web series. This has to be something that is taking over a lot more of your time.
Yeah.
As you become, you know, talk about that experience, the idea of doing something as just one other project, and then that project takes off and gets to this level and it almost defines you.
Yeah, I mean, so I, you know, I'm a poet, and that's what I do. That's kind of where I really cut my teeth and where my craft skills really lie. And so there is this really interesting thing to have tried, like, Brown Girls was my first attempt at screenwriting. It was my first time trying to do anything for screen. And so to see Brown Girls kind of skyrocketing and to be working on poetry for so long and to feel that these two vastly different worlds kind of happening at the same time has been really, really interesting. And, you know, as Brown Girls, I've been working on Brown Girls. I've also been working on my poetry book. And some of these poems I've had for years, you know, and it's like really about arranging the words on every single poem and really thinking about every single line and how you do that. And screenwriting kind of flies a little bit faster because it's so much about dialogue and there's kind of a quickness that comes with.
Oh, yeah. They're different disciplines, right?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah.
Does it change? I mean, is it hard for you to do that?
I don't think so. I think that I have to be in a certain mindset to write either one, right? When I'm writing screenwriting, I can do it whenever. So I can do it like in a cafe and I can do it when there's a lot of noise around me and it's okay because of how noisy it is, right? You have so many characters who are living inside you, so many things that are happening. But with poetry, I really need that space to be quiet and I need to be in a place where I can be reflective. And if I'm not, then like I can't really write poetry. It's hard for me. And so that's kind of the biggest difference is the mentality it takes to either one, but they're really beneficial in the sense of when I'm burnt out on poetry or when I feel like I've hit a wall, I can like delve into screenwriting and vice versa. Yeah.
Right. Brown Girls, let's go back over it. I mean, it stars two women who of color who are in Chicago. It's great. And the great thing about it is it's a comedy and it follows their lives, but it's not necessarily about their what color they are or their identity. I mean, it plays a role in it, but there's something great about it's refreshing in the way that this is a show that is the characters facing forward who are living their lives in a 20-something Chicago. And that's what I loved about it. It's really what I loved about it.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it was really important to just show these characters as human, right? And so when I think about my identity and how it functions day to day, a lot of times it's in the background. It's like the vision that I see a lot of things through, but it's not necessary. I'm not always talking about my identity 24/7. Right, right. And so there's a way that these girls just are girls. They're just girls who can't get their relationships right, right? Like they're girls who like mess up things with their family all the time and where their families are like annoyed at them for not being more like financially responsible, right? Like there's ways that I think that these are very real struggles that almost anybody who has been in their early 20s has felt, right? That feeling of being like, cool, I'm now no longer in school where everything was measured by like what is considered successful. It's really easy to know it's successful if you got an A, right? When you're in the real world, it's not easy to know when things are successful when you're balancing all of these different life decisions. And so that's really where the show lays its heart. And I think specifically thinking about Chicago, thinking about the Chicago artistic community, thinking about the Chicago artistic community of color, and thinking about the ways that these communities are so unique, right? Like there is nothing like Chicago art, and it's so beautiful to be a part of, but it is very much a thing that is so special and that I really wanted to show in the series. And so to me, a lot of like all of these characters came from intersectional backgrounds, but they did because that's just who they are and how they live and the kind of struggles that they face are everyday struggles.
Why do you think it is? Because there's hundreds of articles that are written about Brown Girls, and almost all of them say this is the future of, you know, finally a fresh or unique take on women of color. Mm-hmm. And Hollywood up to this point or people who've been in media, they've glossed over it or they've created, you know, very large kind of swath generalities or stereotypes. I mean, is it that obvious that Hollywood is doing that and you guys aren't?
I mean, I think so. it's really interesting. Like Sam, like you said, this Sam Bailey and I are both women of color. And when you put two women of color in charge of a story that is about women of color, then it's told in a certain way, right? And our cinematographer was a queer woman, right? And so we had all of this way in which we were literally changing the gaze of the show, right? Like when you have a cinematographer that is a queer woman shooting a story about queerness and about womanhood and about all of these different things, like the camera gaze is different. And so there was really a way that I think by empowering all of these people of marginalized identities to really take a step forward and to have control in the artistic production of this series, we had a different series than what is typical of Hollywood, right?
Well, I have so many questions. Let's take a quick break, but I have so many questions about developing and what it means to develop from a web series to something like HBO, which has a lot of there's a track record in doing that. Mm-hmm. Issa Rae and others who've done tremendous work. High Maintenance is one of the HBO web series. Fatima Oskar's in studio with me. She's a Chicago poet, writer, television mogul. She's the creator of Brown Girls, co-creator and writer of Brown Girls, the web series that was picked up by HBO. We'll take a quick break, come back, talk more with Fatima here at the big table. It's Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio tonight. The big table, Fatima Oscar. She is a poet, writer, educator, television producer. Her web series, Brown Girls, was picked up by HBO. Before we move on to your world of poetry, which I have a lot of questions about, what does it mean to be picked up, developed by HBO? How does that work? I mean, they just say, yes, we want that. That's everything about it. Do it again. Or do you have to start from scratch?
Yeah, I mean, HBO is a really amazing network in that, as you mentioned, they have picked up things from the web and made them into series. And what HBO does is they really believe in people's voices. So when they see something and they really like that voice, that's where HBO really thrives. And they're an amazing network to work with. But development is basically, you know, you and your team and the execs kind of talking about story and fleshing out story, and thinking about how to take something that was made for a web format and elongate it and create it so that it has legs that can sustain itself for a long time. And it's a really different process. You know, I think about web series as thinking about moments, right? Like a web series is a lot like a poem in that you're kind of hyper-focused on these moments that these characters are living. And a more standard network show is really focused on story,
right?
And
beginning,
narrative,
middle, end, the whole thing, right?
Yeah, and structure and things like that. So it's a really different world that you're kind of working in.
Do they pair you up with someone like a television producer, showrunner, who's like, oh, this is how it is?
Yeah, I mean, I think the process is different for each for each creator. We have a showrunner named Amy Aniobi who's amazing. So that's been really, really great. And our we have two producers on it, 3Arts Entertainment and MXN. And they're amazing. And so we work a lot with 3Arts and MXN in terms of development and then also with HBO.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. Look at you, Hollywood. I love it. Throwing around 3Arts Entertainment. Fatima, let's talk about your poetry because, you know, in Chicago, a lot of people in the arts community know you as a poet, and you've performed all over town, and you've been a teaching author at Young Chicago Authors, and you've done so much. Let's talk about that. How did you get into poetry? Because you're a performer as well. You've done theater.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about poetry that drew you in?
Yeah, I mean, to me, so in high school, I used to do theater a lot, and I started writing poetry more seriously when I was in college. Like, I would write, like, little poems to, like, people I had crushes on and, you know, in middle school. But then when I was in college, I really saw the way that spoken word was being used in, a blending of performance and poetry. And what really inspired me about poetry was that people were just telling their authentic stories, right? And I think that is so hard to do when you are that age. It is really hard to be like, this is who I am, and these are all the things I believe. And the kind of confidence I saw in that was so compelling to me and was such a thing that drew me in. And to me, poetry has kind of always been a place where I can explain myself, my truest self, very honestly and very vulnerably. And so sometimes, like, there are poems I'll write that even surprise me, that I'm like, oh, this is a truth about myself I didn't know, you know? And it's kind of a way to excavate yourself and to really understand who you are. And I think that's really important to me.
It is an interesting art form because not unlike theater is collaborative in the way that the director or a playwright is going to do exactly what you just said, use their voice, and actors will act it out. Music, and you think of rap music or any others, there's collaboration with the music and the beats. But there's something about poetry, especially the poetry that's evolved in 2017, from think of Louder Than the Bomb and other places that are doing spoken word poetry, where you write it down, you have a microphone, maybe not, you're in the back of a cafe, and you're able to perform a piece. Do you like that? Do you like the collaboration with yourself, this idea that it's you and you alone up there working?
Yeah, I mean, I think that poetry, like, as you're saying, you know, TV and theater, it takes so many people to make that stuff happen. Like, sometimes I just see TV shows and I'm like, that's a miracle it happened, because it just takes so many people to raise that, you know? But for poetry, to me, poetry is a really community-oriented practice, and it is a really collaborative practice, because how I was kind of brought up in poetry was, by these spaces where you would share your work, right? And so you would share your work at, either on a stage or you would share in a circle, and then people would give you feedback. And it was kind of this thing where, you know, and we would slam together and it would be a lot of people giving you edits, or it would be people talking to you about how you performed. And so there's kind of a way that I think people think of poetry as like you sitting by your desk by yourself, which I think an element of it is, right? And then there's also a moment of you sharing with the community, and that poetry kind of being a conversation that happens. And so to me, poetry still has these elements of collaboration that I think are so important to the work. And we even see it with, like, in 2017, you know, like, I think poetry has such a importance in this world, especially in this, like, political world. And whenever something happens, like, some of the things that are most immediate to go viral are, like, tweets and poems, right? And, like, what is a tweet but a small poem, and then a poem that goes viral where people are I'm connected to this, you know? And I think that that kind of virality to me speaks of a need for it. It's like, it's so obvious and evident to me that poetry is collaborative and it's needed, and it's because people are clinging to it in moments of like deep, deep urgency, and when they feel like they don't have anything else.
So, poetry is so interesting when it comes to just the marketing of it, and marketing might not be at the awareness of it,
mm-hmm.
where at one point that was the way that writers communicated.
Yeah.
Then it went to a point where it almost became this elitist form, right, where people only studied it in school and said, oh, it's time for this boring half hour mm-hmm. of poetry. And watching it swing back, and I think about Chicago being the epicenter of this with slam poetry, and even what was happening. I just had the screenwriter of Love Jones that was on the show not too long ago, and that was all about a certain type of spoken word.
Mm-hmm.
And now you see what's happening to young Chicago authors, the Harold Washington Libraries, how that leading into what poetry becomes music, and all the people who are leading pop culture at this point. It's amazing to watch the arc of this. Where do you think it is in 2017? Is it more in the realm of the spoken word, where people are looking at it as it's back to sort of the cool?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's always been that, because that's what spoken word, you know, I have such strong roots in that. But I do think that there is a way that poetry has, I've noticed that there's a different conversation around poetry right now than there was even a few years ago. And it does seem very vital to me. And I think that there is elements, like in Chicago, you know, it's amazing when you have like teams of For Louder Than a Bomb walking around like they're in a sports team, right?
Yeah,
like
right.
That's so
hundreds
so
of kids from high school that get in a tournament,
right?
Louder Than a Bomb, we've talked about it on the show, but if you don't know what that is, it's a tournament citywide that these kids come together and they do poetry competition.
Yeah. And then at, you know, every single Tuesday at Young Chicago Authors, there's a free open mic, and that room is always packed, and it's all of these people who want to share their poems or want to just listen to each other. And so the kind of magic of like communication is so apparent to me, and you see it when a poem goes viral online too, and people are trying to connect to that, you know. And then Chicago is such a artistically rich city. It's such a rich city for words and for music and for poetry. But, you know, there's like Young Chicago Authors, there's the Poetry Foundation, there's all of these spaces that offer free programming that you can come to, that you can, you know, watch these come and like listen to a reading of really, really amazing, talented poets kind of give that to you.
The Poetry Foundation, your Lilly Fellow, mm-hmm. the fellowship, the 2017 fellowship. Talk about that, because that kind of plays into the idea. The Poetry Foundation is an esteemed organization. It's been known worldwide as one of the bearer of poetry. Talk about the contrast or the collaboration between the new and the old that happens at the Poetry Foundation.
Yeah, I mean, I love the Poetry Foundation for this, because I think that they are such arbiters of culture, and it's so amazing to see them being like, all of these things are considered poetry, and we put a platform for all of this. And so, you know, thinking about like my work and thinking about just even my knowledge of Don, you know, who's the editor, Don was the person who like brought in the Breakbeat issue for Poetry Magazine, right? And so had basically opened the doors of Poetry Magazine to all of these folks who are spoken word poets, who come from backgrounds of hip hop and come from a melding of like musicality and poetry, and was like, this is poetry and this is really, really important and you all should like read this, you know? And so I really love that they are so insistent on that, and then that happens. And it's beautiful too, because when we won the Ruth Lilly Fellowship, Don put out a statement about the five fellows who won. And in the statement said stuff around how urgent and important people's poems are in daily life and in community, right? And was saying like that it was really that a lot of the fellows were doing work in community, and that their poems had like significance and meaning. And And a lot of them came from, like, a few of them came from spoken word backgrounds or came from non-traditional academic backgrounds. And I think that that's amazing, yeah. You know?
Fatima Osgur is in studio, Chicago poet, writer, television producer. Brown Girls just picked up for HBO. We'll do this. We'll take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back with Fatima and do second half of the Big Table. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio tonight. The Big Table, Fatima Osgur. She is a poet, writer, television creator, producer. Brown Girls, the web series, now picked up by HBO in development. We're talking about not only her career in poetry, but also Brown Girls. She's got If They Come For Us, the collection of poetry, which will be out soon, Random House. A lot of your work, and we kind of talked about this right at the beginning, was, you know, it's not necessarily everything's about identity. Mm-hmm. But it is, there's a lot of your works around language. And I really like it because you've had such a diverse upbringing with language. Mm-hmm. Let's just start there. In your household, different language was spoken, different language that you used to respond. Mm-hmm. Talk about the role of language when you're creating and writing and performing your poetry.
Yeah, I mean, language is always so interesting to me. I think especially coming, so my family spoke Urdu in the house growing up, and I would respond in English. That's like a very, I feel like it's a very typical like first generation thing to respond in English. And to the point where now I get really, I like can't speak Urdu because I get really self-conscious about it, but I can understand it whenever I hear it. But I think that language is so interesting, especially coming from an immigrant family, because of the way that language is so permeable, right? Like my family, you know, wouldn't understand, like was learning English in America, but would like sing along to rap songs that were on the radio because they were on the radio and didn't know what the words meant, right? And so there was always this like kind of funny thing where my sisters would make fun of my aunts and uncles for doing that because they were singing, like they would sing along a lot to Project Chick, that song, and it's such a nasty song, like the lyrics when you really take apart those words. But it was such an endearing thing to see like my family trying to learn English through these different cultural mechanisms. And so I think that language is so interesting because of its permeability, but also because of its deep histories, right? Like when you start to take apart language and you start to think about individual words and you really learn the origin of those words, there's all of these worlds that open to you. And so I kind of feel like you could be in the pursuit of knowledge around language for your whole life.
Yeah, right. And people are. Yeah.
Yeah. And like not know anything, you know, like there's a way.
We're in such a weird spot too in 2017 where language is weaponized.
Yeah.
And we see this in, I love that you said that Twitter is kind of like little poems.
Yeah.
Because then there are a lot of poets right now. Right? And a lot of people using language in a way that they do have, there is meaning behind
right,
it. And
right.
They're using different words and choices and wanting to make meaning out of different words and the language they're using. I mean, there is something to be said about the power of the written word and how it's used and how it's interpreted.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that, I mean, I was thinking about this. There's this form of poetry called Alande, which is in Afghanistan. And it's like kind of these little couplets that are sung in secret from woman to woman. And they're anonymous. They become part of the fabric of this underground web of women who share them. And tweets are kind of like that too. We were just talking about this, where it's like someone tweets something and you remember the content of the tweet and you don't always remember who tweeted it. But they kind of become part of this like fabric of constant chatter that is around you and these kind of constant little sayings or wisdoms or reactions to the world. And I really love that. You know, I think that there's a real beauty in being able to have people so interested in like their in language and getting that out. And I think it's wonderful.
As a poet, you also work around the concept of identity.
Mm-hmm.
And those two things are connected. And you see language, especially what we're talking about on Twitter and in 2017, language being weaponized about identity.
Mm-hmm.
The word Muslim means something. It seems like it means something different than it did even 2-3 years ago.
Right.
How do you see those two things intertwining, this idea of language and identity? Because in your case, and as I said in the intro, you're who better equipped because of you identify in so many different ways, Pakistani, Muslim, American,
right.
Queer, woman, Chicago. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to see the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that with language and identity, language is so important because it allows you to identify all the ways that you are by yourself and not have people's ideas of identities imposed upon you, right? And so that to me is always a fight in language and in poetry that is so important to me, is being like, it's not like you know, you might hear the word Muslim and think of one thing, and I might be a different Muslim than you might think of, and a different Muslim to another Muslim, right? Because for how many people who are Muslim there are all those ways of being Muslim, right? And I think that
there's a lot of different ways to be Muslim.
Yeah, right? And I think that that's kind of stuff that kind of gets forgotten. And when you see, you know, especially with the current like presidential administration, the way that some of these like words become coded, and you're like, oh, like that is meant to be, that is a racialized thing people are saying, but they're coding it, right? That's like the history of so much of rhetoric in American politics, right? So when you're going back to the war on drugs, or when people are talking about the war on terror, like these are coded things, but you know who people people who say that consider to be worthy of being American or being, you know.
I saw a tweet, and again, I can't tell you who tweeted it.
Yeah.
But it was so telling, and said that we're talking about language and identity, but we're coding words in 2017. Ban, travel ban. Ban is Muslim. Wall, Latino.
Mm-hmm.
And then they say Chicago, black.
Mm-hmm.
That's the words that are being used to replace those words. Mm-hmm. And this person in Twitter saying that's just a way to be publicly racist.
Right.
But you see how language and identity are intertwined, but it's also interesting to see how we code things.
Yeah, and I think it's important for us to, when we see that, to call it out, right? To be like, wait, this is actually racially coded language, but then also to know that we have those same tools to fight back, right? Like language is very, very powerful, and we as artists, as creators, as poets, as whoever we are, as journalists, we can say like there is power in the language that we speak, and we choose to use our language to correct some of this, the racism or the vile, like, you know, hate speech that we see that's so prevalent in the media.
Yeah. I always I loved your poem, and I want to ask a question too, just about a lot of the way you're able to use video and use film, mm-hmm. and other places to express your words, to almost make it a music video for your poem, which mm-hmm. I love. But the one that was, but you're not going to find your name in a keychain, mm-hmm. or on a keychain, yeah. in a store, and how American uses your name and moves it around. And there's something really eloquent in the idea that, yeah, well, there is this idea that we're sometimes Americans across spectrum, even when they feel like they're in good intentions, they use it how they want to use it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's, you know, being a person of color in America, being all of these different identity traits, I've learned very early on when someone is saying something as like as a mean thing, or versus when someone is saying it just out of genuine curiosity,
yeah, right?
So like the question, like, where are you from, doesn't bother me without like a tonal problem, right? When people... I've also heard that question in a really threatening way, and I know what, you know, I know the difference between that.
So tone plays a big role,
right? But I do think that even when some of these questions are well intentioned, or even like, you know, there's a loneliness that happens when people can't pronounce your name. There's a loneliness when your name is always mispronounced, when people don't know where you're from and they assume that you're from somewhere else, right? Like there's these kind of ways that some of those questions hint to a deep truth about who we consider American and who we don't. As an American who you know, was born here and has grown up here, that kind of alienation and loneliness is very palpable. And I think that there's a way that, you know, when I think about why I write poetry, to one of your earlier questions, a lot of it really comes from that feeling of being like, I can be in charge of this language, and I can, you know, I can create a space in this lexicon where I get to be my full self and I get to advocate for people who are like me.
I wonder, I just, you know, I'm curious just about your feelings, your emotions around what's happening in this country when it comes to a travel ban and the way that the current administration is using the word Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as an artist, as a poet, but also as an American.
Yeah. I mean, I was in seventh grade when September 11th happened, and I always knew, you know, as just a racialized person, that I was different and that there was ways that people would treat me differently and, you know, kind of speak to me sometimes in moments that would feel bad. But when September 11th happened, it was really palpable. And there was a way that the kind of Islamophobia that was there, especially when, you know, as a seventh grader, I was like learning, you know, that's like when you get BO, like you're like trying to be like a kid and you have all of this other weight that's added to it. And I remember just having such a deep shame. There was such a shame attached suddenly to being Muslim and to being my skin color and walking around. And, you know, I see that happening again now. And I think that, you know, when you see now as an adult, there's a way that I can just be like, you know, I know that that's not a reflection of me or my family or my people. And I know that stuff is born out of ignorance. But when I work with high school kids, I see how it really damages them, you know, and I see the ways that people say small microaggressive things to them. And that really takes a toll on them. And it makes me really sad. I think that America has a terrible history with racism, right? Like this country was built on Native genocide and on slavery. And yet we don't talk about that. And when people
don't
aren't
want to confront it.
And then people aren't, there's no public memorials to that. There's no real way of where people are held accountable to that, that history. And then therefore, when you kind of see the way that this administration is attacking all of these different groups, right? And like perpetuating this racism in all of these different ways, it's really disheartening. And I would hope that, you know, Americans could counter that, but also, you know, history has shown us that Americans have not, you know? And so I think that, I think it takes a lot of work on all of our behalf to counter those wrongs.
Fatima Asghar is in studio with me, Chicago poet, writer, the woman who is the co-creator and writer of Brown Girls, which was just picked up for HBO in development. You know, another part of your life, which is extremely uplifting. I mean, it's just that you do work with a lot of kids, and you work in Chicago where there are so many great young poets and young people coming through, and yourself included. There has just been I feel like a renaissance. Mm-hmm. Pete and I talk about this all the time, that we'll have people on and it'll be an artist or a rapper, or someone comes in and says, well, I got my start doing spoken word, and then, you know, I got now, and Chance the Rapper's up on stage at the Grammys. I mean, there's something to be said about that all happens here in Chicago. That happens with you. That happens with everything that's happening in the, like you said, the Tuesday night open mics and the places where these kids are getting to express themselves. The Daily Show had a huge piece on young Chicago authors last week.
Yeah.
How does it make you feel that this is happening, and is it happening? I guess that's the question. That does it feel like a renaissance, that there's something special happening in Chicago?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it makes me really proud. And the thing is, like, I'm not from Chicago, but I consider Chicago my home and I've lived here for a while. But there's a way that there's such a fierce pride I feel when I see that. And like, having worked with so many young people in Chicago and just seeing all of these stories, and really I love my students. You know, I go to bat for my students, and I think about the way that I get to see them grow up into the artists they are. And it's just such a beautiful, enriching thing. And I really do think there's a renaissance happening. Like, there's a way that, you know, Chicago is so inspiring. Like, you can walk down the street and go to galleries and be like, these are beautiful. And like, that's not, you know, you don't have to live downtown for that. There's galleries in all of these, in so many.
Do you think that's it? I guess my question is just why. I always wonder what's in the sauce. What's the recipe that these kids are? Well, you see Louder Than a Bomb and you're like, what?
I mean,
how are these kids so good?
Yeah, I think Chicago has a deeply, you know, blue collar work ethic in all that it does. Right, Chicago people, any. They just hustle. And I think that same thing is applied to art, right? I think folks hustle, and I think folks they try a lot, and they expand their voice, they expand what they're doing. And to me, that's so authentic, right? Because people, you're not coming here to like make it in whatever capacity. You're coming here because you want to work, and you're coming here because you want to be part of this community. And so to me, that's really what distinguishes Chicago, and that's why it feels like a renaissance right now.
Well, it also, and I feel like you do this with your work, and it's plain as day when I see it and hear it and read it. But the kids are able to, and this is your teachings and others that are in the community, draw their experiences, their personal experiences, their feelings, everything that's happening to them out, and be able to express it artistically.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's happening everywhere in the way that these are real stories. And I think that has to do with the teachers and people saying, go deep in, find the story, find your voice, and be able to express it.
Yeah, and that's lineage too. Like, that's Gwendolyn Brooks, you know? That's like, that's real Chicago lineage. That's like Studs Terkel. Like, there's a way that I think so many people who've come out of Chicago really have believed in using yourself as the source material and using your communities and looking around you and uplifting kind of the everyday into poetry. And so to me, that's such a, it feels like such a Chicago thing. And I'm so glad that, you know, that's like YCA's teaching pedagogy, and I love it because I think that that's really true. I mean, I think once you kind of realize that you are a storyteller and your stories are worth talking about, like, you're unstoppable, right? And so I think that that's what I see a lot in the way that we teach students, and that you know, a lot of young creatives coming out of Chicago, even who don't come through YCA, I see with that same mentality and logic, and I think that's a really Chicago thing.
Fatima, the book's coming out soon.
Yes.
And then when should we expect to see Brown Girls on the HBO screen?
So I don't have an answer for Brown Girls. Brown Girls, we're still early in development.
Will you shoot it in Chicago?
I'm hoping. You know, we're still, again, early in development, so that's...
Come on, you got to put your foot down.
I know. That's something I'm definitely going to advocate for.
You got to get hard to work with right now, early in your career, right?
You're like, this is what I will not compromise on. No, I mean, I do think that the show is so integral. It is a Chicago show, and it would make me so happy to be able to film here and to film in the ways that we want, you know, and to show Chicago how we want to show it. And so that's something that I think, if we get to that stage, I'm going to be really, really excited about.
Well, the web series Brown Girls, you can find it online. It's still out there from when it ran last year. It was picked up by HBO. We'll see it soon on the screen. Fatima Oscar, poet, writer, television producer. The book If They Come For Us will be out on Random House soon. Also the Ruth Lilly Fellow at the Chicago Poetry Foundation. Fatima, thanks so much for joining us and being at the big table tonight.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Sorry about that, everybody. There we go. It's getting a guest from the lobby. Sorry about that. It's a download here at 720 WGN. I'm just coming. There's a Halloween costume party going on in the Tribune Tower tonight. So there is a ton of, it's like a Grand Central Station out there trying to get the guests out. But that was, anyway, good conversation there. Fatima Oscar. She's great. What a great convo. And I'm so looking forward to seeing if, Brown Girls can, maybe it'd be good, Pete, it'd be like Insecure, like Issa Rae, and then Brown Girls right afterwards. It'd be pretty good. Yeah. All right, coming up at the 9 o'clock hour, I'm very excited about our next conversation. We're going to talk about Akila and the Bee. Now, I was talking to Pete about this earlier, which is fun. And I was like, you know, I was putting together like what we were going to talk about. And I was like, well, there's not too many times that a movie actually gets turned into a stage play. And in this case, that's the case. Akila and the Bee is going from a great movie that was out a couple years back, and it's being produced here in Chicago. But then we started talking about it, and it was like, well, maybe that's not necessarily true. Hairspray would be a movie that turned into a stage play. Then we started to go down the list to like to five or six more, and I'm like, all right, so I scrapped that promo. It's like it never happens this way, and I'm like, well, it does happen this way, so it's not a but we'll talk about literacy coming up here. I'm very excited to talk about it because it's one of those issues when you talk about literacy that I don't know what it is. In the last couple of years, I remember growing up, and I don't know if it was even as a young adult and being a producer, that literacy was a big issue, and the leaders of our city and our state and our country really wanted to dig deep on that and say we all have to get kids at a better reading level and understand words and be a more literate society. And then it just kind of went away. I haven't heard much about literacy. So we'll talk about the goals of the theater company, literacy, and so forth. Hari Kondabolu, the stand-up comedian, will also be with us at 9:30. He will be talking about his new documentary, The Problem with Apu. This is the character that's on The Simpsons. The Simpsons, of course, been on the air for 28 years. Hari Kondabolu is doing a documentary which will be on True TV coming up in November, where he talks to a bunch of people, South Asian descent, comedians and other actors about Apu, and essentially gets to the bottom of how everybody hates that character from that community because it's just a blatant stereotype. Played by a white guy, Hank Azaria, And it's never really, it's kind of always been normalized. We've all just accepted Apu as a funny character on The Simpsons. Everyone's loved it. But no one's really kind of looked into the idea of the cultural insensitivity of that. So Hori Kondabalu, who's a very funny guy, is taking on that issue on a documentary coming up in True TV in November. All right, all that coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Thanks, Rob. It is a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. He said, coming up, Hori Kondabalu is going to join us, stand-up comedian from Brooklyn, who's going to be in Chicago this weekend at the Hideout. Also talk about his True TV documentary, The Problem with Apu. Talk about that coming up at 9:30. Well, right now, my guests tonight are opening up their new show, Akila and the Bee, this Saturday night at the Vidim Theater. It's an adaptation of the award-winning film. It's being presented by Adventure Stage Chicago, a theater company that's dedicating this season to the issue of literacy. The play is directed by longtime Chicago director Daryl Brooks, and a set on Chicago's south side as Akila uses her spelling talent to bring together her community. Adventure Stage Chicago is part of the Northwestern Settlement, a program that's designed to help disrupt generational poverty. And this year, like I said, they're taking on literacy, which is an issue we don't hear about as much as we used to. In studio tonight, director Daryl Brooks and artistic director at Adventure Stage Chicago, Tom Arvidas. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Why Akila and the Bee?
Daryl's looking at me. Oh. Well, it's so important. Akila and the Bee is such an important story. I think it was the movie came out in 2005, I think, and it was important then also. But it's set in the city of Chicago. The play is set in the city of Chicago. And the ability to tell a story about African-American children and be able to tell the story of how they were able to overcome, or any child being able to overcome any adversity, to be able to achieve what they want to achieve their dreams. That's why Akila and the Bee, and that's why it's so perfect for Adventure Stage, the ability to tell that story.
Adventure Stage, it is kind of a perfect fit because this season you're dedicating the season to literacy. Why that topic?
Well, the Settlement House, where the theater has been for the last 15 years doing the work that we do, you mentioned in the opening there that the mission of the Settlement House is to disrupt generational poverty. Well, we know that there are several markers that contribute to generational poverty, and very high on that list is literacy. But we don't just stop at the ability to read and write. We really think of literacy as being able to navigate the world, right?
And understand the world around us, right?
Yeah, and and connect the dots, you know? We think of it as critical literacy, as the ability to think critically about what's happening around you, about a young person's ability to take in a story and interpret the narrative and think about, you know, who's telling that story and what's the point of the story and who has power in the story. Ultimately, we want to get young people not taking the world for granted or just accepting it as it is. We want them to be able to interpret the world around them and ultimately change the world and change themselves.
It's so important too, because I remember in my career, I'd do different stories that when I worked in public radio, they'd be like, today we're going to talk about media literacy. And you would do it and everyone's eyes would glaze over.
Right.
They'd just be like, oh, here they go again, public radio. And it's true. I did too. I was just like, oh, this is so boring. But there's something to be said in 2017 that to understand where that narrative is coming from,
yes,
if there's a slant or bias to the news article that you're reading,
yes,
especially this idea, this fake news. Yeah. But there is something beyond just this concept of understanding that not everything that's put in front of you is the right or correct narrative.
That's right. That's right. I mean, putting that judgment on it, right or correct. I mean,
it's trying to find the right word.
It's really about what is our relationship to that narrative, right? And how is it speaking to me, and how am I relating to it personally? Is this something that that ultimately is having an impact on my life? Am I aware of the impact that this is having on my life, or not? You know, and I think with Akila and the Bee, you know, what we have is an opportunity to explore that through the lens of community. What role does community have in helping, you know, how do people help each other through adversity? And are we sorry. It's the showcase studio that got me.
We're like making strides, you know, making sure that the community showing people that there are people and that there is a community there to help them whenever they need a second chance or whenever they need the ability to overcome whatever obstacles that are there. And that's what Akil and the Bee really tells.
That movie was so well received. It's a critically acclaimed film. Is it tough? And I guess that's the right way to say it. Is it tough to take something that was so beloved on film and put it on stage? I mean, the expectations high, you know, I mean, because obviously this has been done before, but this play to be able to go from film to stage is a little different than stage. We see it more with stage to film. Mm-hmm. As a director, I mean, is there any sort of expectation to be like, yeah, everybody loves it, I better not screw this up?
Well, the only no, that's true too, but the only I guess the only allegiance that I have as far as that goes is definitely to the playwright of the script, and of course to my audience, and make sure that I tell the story. The actual script is different. Is different than what the movie is. I haven't seen the movie since it came out. When Tom finally hired me to do this show, I decided I wasn't going to make them. I was not going to watch the movie.
I was
going to
ask that question.
I was going to make my own choices. I was going to make sure that the actors made their own choices. And we actually created a different show telling the same story. Mm-hmm. And it's so important to do that. It's so important for us to be able to tell our story on top of what's already written.
There's a lesson in that. I mean, this idea that, you know, people, there may be expectations of, because the story was told in one way that people liked, but as we bring it all right back to literacy and narratives, I mean, if you are a theater community and you're able to create a story that people know and fashion it in your own world, there it fits into what you guys are trying to do.
Right, and it goes back to the fact of how can I tell a child, a kid, to use their imagination, to be able to use what they learn and turn it into what they want to turn it into, but I'm going to watch a movie and put it exactly on the stage. It doesn't, we can't do that. That's kind of double-sided, double-handed.
There's also something that happens in our theater, in any theater where young people, well, anybody, you know, you're coming together in a public space and having a shared experience, right? I don't know anywhere else where young people are coming together and having a shared experience and then invited to talk about that experience in that same public setting and hearing the voices of their peers, not only the people they've come to the theater with, but, you know, people from other parts of the city who are all there that in that same space. Young people don't have that opportunity.
Right.
And how are we going to continue to engender that opportunity and have young people who care about, you know, these kinds of experiences? But I don't want that to be limited to just the arts space, right?
Right.
Like in society, coming together and sharing ideas and that's really important.
Fatima was just on, we were talking about this idea of kids getting in touch with their own voice.
Yeah.
And getting this opportunity, if they can tell their own story.
Yes.
Without this unfettered, you know, everything around that's clouding it, but if they can be unstoppable. Mm-hmm. That's what they teach the kids at Young Chicago Authors. That's the main thrust. Is it hard when you're working with kids, on Akil and the Bee, or you're bringing kids to watch a show and they want to talk back? Is it hard to get them to that space? Is it hard to get them to be able to share their story and participate in that way?
No, because we tell their story, right? We have made a commitment as a theater company to put the young person at the center of the story. So when they come in, even if they didn't make the choice to be there, their teacher did or their parents did, the story they're seeing is speaking directly to them because the main character is what's driving that story. Mm-hmm. The young person is driving that story, and they're seeing that young person act heroically, making good, smart choices that are affecting the people around them in a good and positive way. And ultimately, they internalize that. And so once they know we're their ally, they are so bought in. And we've had two audiences of young people already this week, and they're standing up at the end of the show and applauding for Akilah when she's winning that national
yes,
B.
Yes.
Oh, I just gave away the
That's okay, Tom. 90% of America has seen the movie.
Did
anybody
really,
we know how it ends.
Did anybody really
we
think
know how
she
it
lost?
Ends.
Uh-oh.
It's called Akilah the Bee. What do you think is going to happen?
Artistic director of Venture State Chicago, Tom Arvidas, and studio director Daryl Brooks. Akilah the Bee starts this Saturday night at Vidim Theater, runs through November 26th. You're working with kids. You know, Daryl, for you, you've had experience before. You've worked at Black Ensemble Theater, other places. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're working with kids, Akilah the lead. Is there any other? Is there a different approach than working with adults, actors, to get the best performance out of them?
Well, you know, I mean, working with kids in general can be hard. Luckily, I don't have to work with very, very young kids, especially for the time that we've had to put the show together. But you know, you have to come at children in a whole totally different way. You have to make them understand, and they actually are sponges. They can learn lines like nobody else, and they have the drive and they have the ambition to make it happen. So it's really exciting to work with kids when we work with them. I mean, it really gives us a chance to be able to, as a theater community, to really, you know, up our game.
Do you have to change your approach as a director? If you're like, again, like,
you do sometimes. You know, I've been known to not have the cleanest of mouth when I direct shows. So, you know, when you do that, when we are working with kids of all ages, then it, you know, you have to clean that up a little bit. And, you know, you have to definitely take your time and make them really understand what's going on.
Tom, you know, I'm fascinated with Adventure State Chicago and the Northwestern Settlement, because using arts and culture to disrupt generational poverty is a great notion. I mean, it's great, and it's a good place to do that because you tell stories. But how are you accomplishing that? I mean, in the way of just telling these stories, Akilah and the Bee is a good story to tell and bring community together. But at the end of the day, to do so, it seems like there needs to be more that comes to the table than just a play that people come see.
That's right. No, that's absolutely right. And we are just a piece of that organization. There's a lot that happens there. And the people who come to that organization to make this change in their life, they're relying on a lot of different services to make that happen. For the theater, I do also think it has to be a rich experience, not just as a passive audience member. We are actually a participatory arts organization. So we look for every opportunity to engage with that audience member and have them participate in some way. Simple ways in our lobby, they have opportunities. Pre and post show, from their seat, they can converse with a moderator and the cast. But we're also in classrooms. We are also commissioning new plays, and part of that new play development process includes community members, kids in classrooms, working directly with a playwright. And we have our residency work is also story based. So, you know, it really comes down to, not unlike your last guest, getting people connected to their own story and making them the storytellers of their own lives. Mm-hmm.
Daryl, for you, you look at spelling bees in a different way now, just
completely,
immersing yourself in this.
Completely. You know, it's a sport. It is a sport. It is competitive. It is a sport. You know, I mean,
don't they air it on ESPN?
And yeah, it is.
They do, right?
Man, and it is cutthroat. And you know, at times you feel bad because, like, these kids, they practice for years and years and years, and then it might come down to one letter.
So strange. Yeah.
It's so stressful.
Yeah.
You know, actually, I don't know how I feel about spelling bees after, you know, after doing the show. You know, it really is so stressful, but it's, you know, and the parents are just as bad. You know, I mean, they really want them to win. It's so competitive.
Yeah.
But it is all in the vein of learning and literacy and education. And, you know, those kids are 10, 11 years old and be able to talk you and I underneath the table. right now. Right you now. Know?
No, I think that's what Cheryl really did with this play, too, is by connecting it to community and relationships and our reliance on the people around us, right? We're not celebrating the story of a young girl who locks herself in a room with a dictionary, you know, for you know, 10 years or yeah. whatever it is, right? This is about the power that we get to overcome these huge moments, mm-hmm. right? When the pressure is on, who are we relying on in those moments? It's the people we surround ourselves with and who step up and surround us, you know?
The story of community in this show is just, and that's what it is for me. The spelling bee is like a catalyst, you know, to get yeah. us through. But what this community does to surround her and support her and kind of put their arms around her and hold her while she's not only doing the bee but dealing with life. It's just simply amazing. And these actors in the show just really bring it to life.
The show is Akilah and the Bee. It's going to start Saturday night. It opens at the Vitum Theater, Vittum Theater, running till November 26th. What's the best website for people to get tickets for?
www.adventurestage.org.
Adventurestage.org. That is Tom Arvidas. He's the artistic director at Adventure Stage Chicago. And the director is Daryl Brooks. Guys, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you,
Justin.
All right, Hari Kondabolu is coming up, stand-up comedian. It's going to be at The Hideout, his documentary, The Trouble with the Problem. Not the trouble. The Problem with Apu. It's coming up on True TV. I think it's a fascinating look. Talks to South Asian performers, comedians, friends who talk about their issues with the character Apu on The Simpsons. 28 years. It's a character that, for many, it's a stereotype. Stereotype of Indian culture, owning a quickie mart, the accent. Doesn't help that it's played by a white guy. There's a lot that goes into it that we never really talk about. We normalize and say, yeah, it's funny. But Hari Kondabolu and a lot of younger South Asian performers are saying, hey, maybe not so culturally sensitive. Something to think about. So that's coming up here on The Download. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is making his return to The Download. Hari Kondabolu is coming to Chicago this weekend. Kondabolu is a Brooklyn-based comedian that's coming to The Hideout on the 29th. He put out a couple of albums, including the one we talked about, Mainstream American Comic. And coming up in mid-November, Kondabolu's documentary will air on True TV. It's called The Problem with Apu, a documentary about going head-to-head with a stereotype.
I hate Apu.
Hate Apu.
And because of that, I dislike The Simpsons.
The whole series.
Yeah.
I love The Simpsons because...
You hate yourself. My name is Hari Kondabolu. I've had a great career filled with laughter, critical acclaim. I should be completely happy, but there's still one man who haunts me. Apu Nahasapimapetilon.
Please pay for your purchases and get out and come again.
The Simpsons, stereotypes, all races.
The problem is, we didn't have any other representation.
Cabby, 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 deli, deli, deli. Doctor.
You know that a white guy does the voice?
A white guy doing an impression of a white guy making fun of my father.
How do you feel about that?
Oh, I'm making a movie about how much I dislike it.
Hari Kondabolu, welcome back to The Download.
Hey, man, it's great to be on again.
Thanks for coming back. Obviously, you're continuing to tour. Before, I want to talk to you about this documentary because it looks awesome watching the trailer. You know, as you tour around, do you find yourself, is it a greatest hits kind of tour? Or are you finding new material as you snake through the Midwest and through the area?
I mean, I feel like I'm constantly writing. I mean, this is my next hour that I'm trying to, like, get down and finalize. Like, I feel good about it. Certainly, there's some updates and things because of the election. But I think, you know, at its core, I think it's a lot of, you know, the kind of stuff I do. There's a lot of stuff about race and gender. There's discussions of, like, power dynamics. And also, I got some really silly stories and some family stuff. I'm pretty excited about what this hour is. I think it's, like, the core of what I do, but it's also new approaches and new ideas. So, yeah, man, I'm like, excited to share it with Chicago.
When do you know when an hour is ready?
I mean, I think it's the flow. You just know when you're starting to get sick of the material, that's a good sign. And also when you feel like it builds well. Because, you know, I can fill an hour, but it's about it being the right hour. Like, I really believe that stand-up is a wonderful recorded art form. I've always seen it as a recorded art form, and I want to be, you know, someone who's putting out work, not just performing, but putting out work. And I think when you see an arc in a show, or when you see a bunch of pieces connect smoothly, and maybe the show is taking on some themes, I think that's an hour that I'm seems like, okay, with a few touches here and there, I can record this and put it out.
I always think about, you come up with a great joke and you can put it on a podcast with W. Kamau Bell, or you could put it on a TV show, whatever it might be. How do you pick the platform when you're talking about, even with this hour, there's a lot of different stories and funny stuff and stuff about political and race, gender, stuff that you know. How do you decide what's the best place for that joke?
Well, it always goes to the stand-up. You know, whatever it is will end up there. Even if I do it on a podcast, you know, when you do it on a podcast, it's quickly written. You're writing to a topic, and often you forget about things. But if something sticks out and you feel like you can make it stronger, that ends up in the act. And to me, everything comes down to the stand-up. Everything I do is built for the stand-up. So it will always end up there if it's good enough.
Hori Kondabolu is my guest. His documentary will air on True TV coming up here in mid-November. It's called The Problem with Apu, documentary about going head-to-head with a stereotype. This is, of course, about Apu, the character on The Simpsons. This is a documentary where you talk to other South Asian writers, comedians, actors, about their reaction or their thought on the character Apu. Where'd this idea come from?
I did a piece on W. Kamau Bell's old show, Totally Biased, and I used to be a writer on it. And Kamau would have his correspondents do pieces if there was a topic that we really wanted to talk about. And so I decided to write about Mindy Kaling's new show. This was when the Mindy Project had just come out.
Right.
And so I was doing this whole write-up and trying to like create the history, like a brief history of South Asian representation in America to set up why the show was special. And while I was doing that, I was writing about Apu and all these, you know, different stereotypical images. And it felt kind of corny. It felt like, oh, like this again, like, I'm sure this has been discussed to death and it seems cliched. And, you know, I tell this to Kamau when I was having second thoughts about writing it. And Kamau's like, this is not cliched. No one talks about Apu. Like, your community has for 20 years, but nobody outside your community ever really has. And I never really thought about that. I just assumed we were all on the same page about him. So, you know, I decided to do the piece. The piece did well, got passed around. It went viral. It's something that people still study in college classes. People have played and put on their curriculums. So it gave me a sense that this was a bigger issue and a more interesting issue than I really thought.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to make a documentary film, and this seemed like the perfect topic because clearly there was interest in the topic, and I know there was a ton of material. There was tons of ideas, people to interview, you know, background stories, and plus it's The Simpsons. You know, I think it's really fascinating because The Simpsons, it's like still my favorite show. And The Simpsons, like, has never really been criticized, other than maybe it's not as strong as it used to be.
Yeah.
That, to me, was an interesting documentary.
It really is. And you think about that, too, even in researching, watching the trailer and learning about the documentary. You know, I'm a white guy. It's interesting because I always just assumed, wrongfully so, that it was somewhat culturally okay because nobody really, there was no protests over it. There were no, you know, right. Other people talking about it or getting the kind of response that you would get from other races being stereotyped. But you're absolutely correct. Think about Apu owning a Quickie Mart, the accent, everything about it. This is a stereotype that people from South Asia, South Asian descent, have had to deal with for a long time.
Right. And, you know, to me, you know, a stereotype is annoying, but when it's the only thing you have, when it's the only character, then there's nothing to contrast it. You know, like that's all you get. And really, it's less about me and my generation, but more about my parents. You know, it's really mocking them. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's a cartoon character. But when you think about, like, the insecurities you feel thinking that no one cares about who you are and your culture, and you're embarrassed about who you are and your culture, and even if that's not childhood bullying anymore, like, that seeps into who you are. And, mm-hmm. You know, it's a little different now. I think kids now are a little more spoiled. They have options. But back then, that was all we had. And it was hard to, like, define yourself as American when everyone's telling you you're not.
The complication of this character as well is it's played by a white man. Hank Azaria does the voice and makes no qualm about it. In the documentary, there's much footage of him explaining it in funny ways or even playing into the stereotype. It almost plays out as a modern-day minstrel. I mean, this is something that is akin to what was happening on the vaudeville circuit in the early part of the 20th century.
And that's something we talk about in the film. You know, you know, I don't think it's the same as what, you know, black people have had to deal with, obviously, but I do think it's part of a larger legacy that starts there. I think this kind of like minstrelsy and buffoonery of and caricatures of people of color, you know, that's been around since the beginning of this country, and we see how it still kind of plays out. I mean, The Simpsons never expected to be on 30 years, you know, so this is kind of a fossil. Like, Apu is a fossil that we still get to see, because the show is kind of the amber. You're just kind of, it's still around, and you can't believe it's still around, but it's still around. So they created it in an era where there was not going to be protest, where there wasn't a strong enough community. And the fact that, you know, I don't think enough people knew who we were and what, you know, what we did and our culture. I mean, the only time I ever saw Hinduism in mainstream media is when Apu talked about it. The only time there was a discussion of any kind of Indian culture, it was because Apu did something. That's kind of absurd.
Another part of the absurdity of it is that this idea that people who say, oh, what's the big deal? What is it, you're a snowflake? Can't you just let this go? What, so overtly PC, you know, can't we just have anything? But you call it out in the trailer. This is not a new show. This is something that you've been biting your tongue on for 28 years.
Yeah, it's something that, you know, I've either bit my tongue on or haven't had a chance to say anything. You know, that's the other thing. The idea of South Asian Americans speaking for themselves, that's a new concept. Like, when I started doing stand-up, you know, there was Russell Peters, Mindy Kaling was on The Office, you know, Aziz had started to get bigger, and there's Cal Penn. There's only a handful of people, and they were all fairly recent. So the idea of us being able to speak for ourselves and sharing our stories and, you know, kind of filling in that picture that hadn't been filled in, that's all new.
Yeah.
I mean, it is very strange to see it.
What kind of feedback have you gotten as you put this together? Obviously, it airs in mid-November, but more and more people, not unlike me, going, yeah, that's a no-brainer.
Honestly, that's my favorite reaction, are the people that are willing to listen to the argument, all of a sudden it hits them, or people who, like, see it for the first time. Because at least I know that people are paying attention, if that's happening. People are at least paying attention to the documentary and trying to understand it. The reactions that always frustrate me are the people that say, this is politically correct, you're a snowflake, you don't understand The Simpsons, you don't get it. And it's like, first of all, I'm a huge Simpsons fan, I do get it. Like, The Simpsons makes fun of pop culture. What's more Simpsons than me making fun of The Simpsons? I feel like it's in the tradition. And also, I hate the idea of people criticizing something they haven't seen yet.
Yeah,
it's not out. You have not seen it. So I feel like when people criticize it, you know, I've had a few hate mails. And I wrote back. I don't usually write back, but I wrote back, hey, watch the film.
Save
and write
it, right.
To me after November 19th.
Right, exactly.
November 20th, I'll expect your hate mail. But for now, like, watch the film and see how you feel.
Well, the documentary, The Problem with Apu, documentary about going head-to-head with a stereotype, is on True TV on November 19th. Stand-up comedian Hari Kondabolu is coming to Chicago this weekend. He'll be at the Hideout on the 29th. Hari, thanks so much for taking some time out to talk to us about the documentary, but also about your stand-up. Good luck with the show this weekend.
I appreciate that, Justin. The show, the advance tickets are sold out, but there's tickets at the door, and I'd love to see you.
Hari Kondabolu is playing up the Hideout, 29th. We rile people up. Get a lot of texts in. Isn't every character in The Simpsons a stereotype? From Cletus to Grandpa to Chief Wiggum, the list goes on. I think it's just getting to the point when everything is offensive to everyone. And where does it end? I mean, I haven't seen. I should take Hori's advice, because he said, "Hey, you know, I haven't seen it." I saw the trailer and I read a bunch of stuff about it, but it didn't give me a screener to watch before. So I should probably wait to watch it before I make judgment. But I think there's something to be said. I mean, Hari says, listen, no, we did not have a voice. South Asian people did not have a voice in Hollywood in whenever that show started, 1990 or something, like 1990, whatever. So you can understand why there's a little cultural insensitivity to the idea that if that is a stereotype that makes a certain type of person, and in the trailer, these are popular people that all say they have a problem with it, then, well, who are we to say? Who am I as a white guy to say, no, you can't? How dare you? What are you talking about?
Yeah, and Chief Wiggum, you know, the example in the text, you know, that, you know, sure, that's making fun of police, you know, lazy, dumb, donuts.
Right.
That's not a race.
Right.
It's either you're making fun of an occupation or you're parroting, not parroting, but satirizing an occupation.
And you know, Cletus, they meant to mention Cletus is the guy from the South, which is offensive, I'm sure, to people in the South, but played by someone of the same color. Somebody white is playing Cletus. Somebody white is playing Apu. Like, I don't know. There's something to that where I'm like, I don't think that would be you couldn't do that to an African American character.
Yeah, this is a great time of year because Halloween is approaching, and invariably,
inevitably,
you'll see the celebrity with the blackface costume.
It's usually, and by celebrity, you mean frat house guy from Indiana University.
Or I think
somebody did it last.
Yeah,
year.
I think there's a few celebrities, but then, you know, so say there you see a white guy who dresses up like an Indian guy who works at a 7-Eleven or something and does a weird voice, you know, like the accent.
Yeah, you would find it to
be offensive. Yeah,
and it's funny because I'm in comedy and I've never done an Indian accent, you know, as white guy, but I've been around comics that have. You know, they've done sketch comedy, have done it, they've gotten big laughs. Yeah, I don't have any, I'm not good with voices. This is my voice.
Mm-hmm.
630 says, if Waylon Smithers is voiced by a gay man, is he? Because if not, then you better have a gay person on to say how they're offended they are. All right. You know, I don't understand. And I guess that was his point in the interview, that people get so bent out of shape about him just asking the question.
Mm-hmm.
And people are so defensive to defend The Simpsons, or they laughed it up. I don't know what it is. Because I love The Simpsons. Everyone loves The Simpsons. Everybody loves The Simpsons.
No, Cal Penn does not.
Yeah, Cal Penn does
feature
not.
In the trailer. But
708 says, Fez on that 70s show, Raj on Big Bang. Indian people got it bad on TV sometimes. I don't know what that means. But 630 says, you two have a mental disorder. Get help. I don't get it. I don't know. I think it's a lack of empathy. I don't know.
I think it's okay to question this.
Yeah, I think it's okay. I don't understand. I love The Simpsons. I actually like the character of Apu, but I also, if it's offending people, and it sounds like from Hari, and maybe he's wrong, and the documentary suggests that he's not, that there's a community of South Asians that find it offensive. So we're just supposed to go, how dare you speak? I don't understand.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get deep in the weeds in this, but just like, you know, with Native Americans who don't like Chief Yahwahoo or the Indians, you know, that little, you know, I mean, that's, I know we're different, but if a group of people are upset with something like that, I think it's fair to listen to their why they're upset.
And in the documentary, the trailer I saw, I mean, Hank Azaria and Dana Gould, who's on the show this week, Dana Gould just says some accents are just funny. That's what he says. And Hank Azaria has funny, he kind of has a couple of points where they catch him in interviews kind of making fun of the fact that he does it. You know, they don't come across, I mean, I know there's a defense of it from some of our listeners tonight, but they even when you look at those clips in the trailer, you're like, and maybe they're taken out of context. I got to watch the whole thing. But you're kind of like, really? That's your approach to it? That just some accents are funny? It doesn't matter? I mean, I see it all the time in Chicago. I mean, we do enough times in Chicago media where people put on accents of different ethnicities that aren't theirs, and they got something to say about it. But, I mean, in this case, this was the idea that the cartoon character is Indian, brown-skinned, and I know it's a character, I know it's a cartoon, and that's going to be the next thing that comes in, I get it, and played by a white guy who can do an Indian accent. I don't know, I'm trying to be objective and show some empathy to say, yeah, that probably would rub people the wrong way. I don't know, I'm okay saying The Simpsons are still top quality, Peabody Award winning, they're the best. I mean, it's amazing, I love a lot of stuff they've done. But it's okay to also go, yeah, but that one character they did back in 1990, you know? Yeah.
I still get very offended at Roz on Frasier for her job behind the scenes, you know.
But I mean, I wonder. I mean, there's a lot of stereotypes. I mean, 815 says because it makes us laugh. Remember Amos and Andy? Yeah, it makes you laugh. It makes you laugh. But what if Amos and Andy, the concept of what they're making fun of, the people who they're making fun of, they don't think it's funny. So I don't know, at a certain point where cultural sensitivity has to take over. I know I sound PC and I know I sound, you know, whatever you want to call it, but I don't think the world where we're at in 2017, find other jokes. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I'm off, but just find other jokes. Kill a poo off. I think Don tried that a couple times and have him be replaced by a millennial. Like an Aziz Ansari character that Aziz Ansari plays, right? I'd be okay with that. I don't know. I think that there's no... I also think you can make an argument that there is no precedent for this because this show started in whatever year it was. I mean, yeah, 1989, 1990. And think about that. That is a different time where if you were doing an Indian at a Quickie Mart, there weren't a lot of South Asian people in Hollywood or other places to stand up and go. There wasn't an internet. There wasn't Twitter to go, that's offensive. Now there is. So at a certain point, go, all right, that no one intended this show to go for 28 years. It's about, no, but it is. So you can't just sort of fall back. We would not accept it from other shows. We wouldn't accept a show from a different time to be on now, an Archie Bunker or something like that, and be like, yeah, that's an okay character to have on TV. We just wouldn't accept it. Times change. I'm not the arbiter of that. Anyway, I'm tired. I love it. Thank you for the conversation, everybody. Sue's got a nice one here, too. Just about, she doesn't buy it. She says, Hari makes a valid point, but he mentions the positive Indian character who's Apu's wife. And yeah, I guess that's true. Probably not played by an Indian woman, but I don't know that. Anyway, I'm looking forward to the documentary. I think it'd be cool. I'm looking forward to it. I will put it in the queue. You at home don't have to. That's how it works. All right, coming up, John Lankford, Four Lost Souls. We're going to talk with John Lankford, John Szymanski in studio. We'll talk to them about their new project where they are channeling Muscle Shoals. Muscle Shoals, Alabama. That's coming up. Stay with us. 708 says it's always going to be that no matter what is said, it's going to offend someone. That's just the way it is in this day and age. I don't know about that.
Yeah.
I don't know because I feel like Hollywood is evolving because the viewer is evolving. We don't accept racial stereotypes anymore in our media. We just don't. I mean, sometimes it gets around nuanced and maybe the concept or the parameters or the boundaries of what is considered a racial stereotype change. But there's nothing that you can't come out with a movie in the summer blockbuster and be like, and a stereotype of a black guy. Like you couldn't do it. No one would accept. We wouldn't accept it.
Well, let me play devil's advocate though, real quick. And I'm taking it to the extreme, granted. But let's just say you walk up to somebody and say hi in the morning. Well, what do you mean by hi? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, what the...
You know what I mean? What are you talking about? Hi. You know,
that's not what this is.
No, I understand that.
I mean, this is a character that was a stereotype of Indian Americans who came to this country and they started at working at delis and quickie marts and whatever you have. And they make that stereotype and it's funny and people laugh and Apu has got some great lines and Hank Azaria is amazing at it.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it is a stereotype of, you know, for Indian people in America.
Yeah, but isn't it funny, though? And let me just use an example of like maybe a Jewish comedian talking about the quote unquote Jewish condition. You know, some of these guys out there are hilarious talking about stereotypes.
Right. Talking about themselves.
Right.
Right. But the problem in this case is Hank Azaria is not an Indian Quickie Mart owner.
Yeah, I get it. I'm with you on that one. I'm with you on
I
that
know.
One.
I'm not making Jerry, you know, he texted in saying, don't we have bigger problems to deal with? I'm like, I'm not putting this on the same pedestal as nuclear war. We can have a conversation.
Damn it, Justin. Stop doing that.
I don't know. I think it points to a lack of empathy in some cases where we're like, hey, if I don't know, I don't ever want to do comedy that offends a certain type of person, like an entire race. I mean, that's ridiculous. Nobody does.
I don't think
that they thought they were doing that. And if you know, it's brought to their attention, I'll bet that a lot of those very smart, you know, very well off or well educated writers at The Simpsons, I think they would look at it and say the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't feel like I'm destroying The Simpsons or crushing The Simpsons' will to live. I just question whether or not I agree with Hari Kondabolu that maybe and a lot of actors that are in that trailer. This isn't my argument. I'm piggybacking on it. That they say, yeah, there's something about Apu that just doesn't sit right.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my guest tonight just put out a new album. It's called John Lankford's Four Lost Souls. John Lankford is a musical treasure here in Chicago, whether it be punk with the Mekons or rock and country with the Waco Brothers or a solo career that explores country and roots music. John was in here a little while back talking about his pilgrimage to Muscle Shoals, the area in northern Alabama alongside the Tennessee River that holds magic for musicians. Whether it's Aretha Franklin, the Rolling Stones, or even the Black Keys, Muscle Shoals is home to something special. And John Lankford's Four Lost Souls honors the music and the magic as it was recorded and produced over a four-day session at the Nut House Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, back in 2016. John Lankford, Bethany Thomas, Tawny Newsom, and John Szymanski make up the Four Lost Souls. And two of those souls are in studio tonight, John and John. Johns?
Two Johns.
Two Johns. Good to see you. Thanks for being here.
It's lovely to be here.
I really wanted to have a conversation about music and place because I've heard so much in the last couple of years about Muscle Shoals. And I love music and I'm a big fan of music. But I have never really caught on to what makes that area of the country special when it comes to the music that's been produced there. John, why don't you give us a quick history lesson?
Well, for me, I don't know. It'll be very personalized because I'm an English, not English, English, I'm Welsh, but I grew up in, you know, Britain. Yeah. And anyone who grew up in Britain in the sort of post-war years, as you might call them, were just fascinated by American music in general. And some of the greatest American music came out of that area. When I think of my relationship to America, the things I love about it and the things I don't like about it, you know, the South seems to be quite big in both those camps. And a lot of the great things that came out of America came out of the South. And for me, when I met Norbert Putnam in Nashville, he asked me to go to Muscle Shoals. I'd never really thought about that as a possibility or thought that much about my involvement in that form of music other than as a fan, but then right. To actually go there and be part of it, I had to really kind of think about what the place was about. And, you know, there's a documentary that came out recently with sort of Bono talking about, you know, the rusty earth giving up the sound of the music and all this rubbish. And it's not that. What was going on there was actually a kind of, in the South, an interesting thing because it was... music is far more segregated now than it was then, and what was going on then was a kind of almost utopian thing with between black people and white people making what was the greatest sort of soul music to come out. With that and Stax, you know, both similar situations with you know, they were kind of colorblind, and musicians were transcending those racial barriers to make sort of music which was socially important and just really powerful.
What was how much of it came out of the Nashville scene? It's only 100 miles from Nashville. Does Nashville have any sort of, you know...
Nashville had a kind of R&B scene as well, but it's no, you know...
Does that influence Muscle Shoals at all?
I mean, I don't know that much about it, but there's a lot of black music in Nashville, but it's, you know, it kind of gets written out of the history books. It's like Chicago, you know, there was a lot of country music in Chicago with the WLS Barn Dance, but that gets written out. And it's like Nashville country music, Chicago blues music, you know.
It's like, yeah, I think there, between Nashville and Muscle Shoals, there's a lot of duality because people from Muscle Shoals would move to Nashville to make it in the big time. And then they would come back to, you know, and kind of use their magic that they learned in Nashville and come back and do more sessions back in the Shoals, which is kind of how Norbert worked, actually.
Well, Norbert said to me the first time I met him, he says, well, you know, I moved up to Nashville when I was like 25. People told me, you know, I was down in Muscle Shoals, and people told me I was playing black music, and then I moved up to Nashville, and they told me I was playing white music, but I was just playing the same thing, you know? But I met Norbert through this amazing exhibition at the Country Music Hall of Fame called Dylan, Cash, and the Nashville Cats, which is this kind of it's a really great revisionist history of what actually really went on in Nashville. Like, the myth is that Bob Dylan went down there and turned on all the straights with his groovy 60s-ness. But really, he went there because there was people there in Nashville, like Charlie McCoy, Norbert Putnam, all these guys who were, you know, they grew up on Elvis. They weren't coming out of the country tradition. So when they were teenagers, they got into Elvis. And through Elvis, they got into James Brown and Ray Charles and stuff like that. And that's where Muscle Shoals comes from. Rick Hall, who ran the Fame Studios in Muscle Shoals, lucked on a bunch of kids who were just like completely literate in the kind of those musical forms.
And were the kids coming to Muscle Shoals? They were coming there to record music, or
no? They were living there.
They were living there.
They were just living there.
Yeah.
That's just,
Norbert grew up there in Florence, Sheffield. You know.
For you guys to go down there just recently to work on this album, why? Why? What was it about going there and recording a record that had to be? You had to go there. You had to do this record in Muscle Shoals. You had to go there, bring all the musicians to Four Lost Souls. Why?
Because I met Norbert Putnam and he asked me.
that is the
truth. It was just simple. Well, he asked me once. They had an opening ceremony for that Dylan Cash exhibit, and really it was honoring the Nashville Cats. But Norbert's got a foot in both camps because he was a Muscle Shoals guy, like right. David Briggs as well. So after the gig, which they allowed me to sing at the Country Music Hall of Fame,
how great was that?
It was fantastic. But I was not really expecting that. And afterwards, Norbert came up and says, "Man, you sing like a pirate. You should come down to Muscle Shoals." And I was going, "Is that pirate music big down in the shoals at the moment?" And he said, "No, you should come down and make an album." So he told me he was living back down there. Then I didn't think anything more of it. And 6 months later, I ran into him again. And he remembered who I was. And then he was kind of mad with me that I haven't got in touch. So then it was like, Mark Guarino was with me. He was a journalist in town here. You probably know Mark.
Yeah.
And he said, I heard that, and now you have to do it.
I've documented that, right?
So I wrote all the songs for this album with that in mind, with the idea that I was going to go. And a lot of them I was working at the Country Music Hall of Fame at Hatch Showprint for quite a lot of that year as artist in residence. So I was just writing songs while I was down there, and I had access to all the archives at the Country Music Hall of Fame and bookshop and stuff like that. So it was.
What kind of research goes into creating music for a record that will be produced in Muscle Shoals?
To think about what it was about, and I thought it was about the South, and it was about the things I liked and hated about the South. You know, an easy description is the fantastic culture that blossomed there, and then the terrible, bloody historical shadow it casts. You know, and it was kind of ironic that we went in the studio to make that album the week Trump was elected, when all this stuff, you know, that you hoped was consigned to the past is suddenly bubbling up. You see Trump arrive and you see the zombies kind of crawling out their graves to rake us through all this terrible history again and again. You know, so, it was quite frightening. Really.
John, what did you know about Muscle Shoals before you got involved in this project?
Well, I knew that's where a lot of great records that I enjoyed came from, you know, and I knew that's where Paul Simon's, that's where There Goes Rhyme and Simon, that record, it's got a Kodachrome and Take Me to the Mardi Gras and all that. That was David Hood, who played on a record. He was the bass player, and that was amazing to me. You know, I knew there was Bob Seger stuff, and I knew that there was Staple Singers and things like that. And I knew that a lot of the music from Memphis in the early 70s, like Big Star and things like that, and I knew that there was some kind of correlation as well, and just that whole magic of that area, like where you could kind of go and make whatever music you wanted, and it would come out sounding great. And so it didn't matter. And for me, I was super excited to become a part of this project because I got to, you know, meet these people and just kind of visit the studios that were the big hit makers of the day. It was great. Yeah.
So. You saw the toilet seat that Mick Jagger was sitting on when he wrote Wild Horses,
didn't you?
I didn't go.
Bethany
and John went over to Muscle Shoals Sound, which has just reopened.
Yeah, it's just reopened. It was due to Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine saw the doc, and they got money together through Beats Headphones to restore the studio. And so it was almost open. We kind of drove by on a Saturday, and we saw people coming out. So we're like, oh, let's go in and see. And it wasn't really open yet. But they let us kind of take a look around. It was us and Mark Wiener and Grant, and we all came together. And they're like, look at that toilet seat. And sure enough, there's a and it's actually, if you look at the Black Keys record that they did there, too, it's still in that picture as well. But it's above the bathroom, and apparently they're working on Wild Horses, and Mick Jagger went in the bathroom, which is inside, it's off to the side of the live room. So you're in the live room, and there's a bathroom. So there's no privacy at all. It's just, there it is. And apparently he was in the bathroom writing the lyrics as they were making the track. So
come on, man. Like, one second.
Yeah.
Finish this.
Well, I got a great photo of Bethany Thomas playing the piano that Aretha Franklin played on, you know, the first session that she did.
Man.
In the scene. In Fame, we went over to Fame Studios as well.
Yeah.
We recorded at the Nut House because David Udd and Norbert Putnam both said that was the studio to go to.
All right, let's do this. Let me take a quick break so we stay on time tonight. But I would I want to pick right back up there, because when you talk about Muscle Shoals and Sheffield, Alabama, and that area, I want to know more about the studios. You guys just rattled through some of the great stories that accompany the historic music that we all know that came from Muscle Shoals. John Langford, John Szymanski in studio. The new album is called John Langford's Four Lost Souls, out on Bloodshot now. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, two of the Four Lost Souls, John Langford's Four Lost Souls. The new album is out on Bloodshot. It's available now. In studio with me tonight, John Langford, of course, and John Szymanski. John, I feel like every time there's any sort of live music on the show, you're in the band that comes in, which is great to see you over and over and over. And we'll hear some live music in a bit.
Yeah.
Let's get back to Muscle Shoals, because you mentioned Fame Studios. You mentioned the studio that Mick Jagger and the toilet, and you mentioned what you guys did at Nut House.
Yeah.
Explain the area. Kind of got intrigued by it's along the Tennessee River, and there's little, really small studios that pepper the area that is Muscle Shoals.
It really kind of came out of almost nothing. It came out of a bunch of teenagers. I think Norbert met Arthur Alexander, and he was a guy who had a song, and they were looking for a singer. He was a black guy who was a bellhop at a hotel, and they went up into some kind of little warehouse space they had, and they started trying to cut some tracks, and they found this guy, Rick Hall, who'd got a tape machine. This is really early on, really primitive, but they had hits, you know, right away. And then people got really fascinated with it. You know, its legend grew really, really quickly. And the Beatles were obsessed with Muscle Shoals, the stuff that came out of Muscle Shoals, so much so that the Muscle Shoals rhythm section, including Norbert Putnam, opened for the Beatles in D.C. on their first gig.
That's amazing.
And Norbert was right down the front with his Super 8 camera filming them. <you know? laughs> And they weren't that impressed with the Beatles at the time, till they saw him play. And then
right,
he was
like, oh,
yeah, we get it.
Yeah, it was like, oh, they couldn't tune their guitars, or, you know.
Well, what is the sound? Because we talked about what the place and the space, and we talked about the multiculturalism and the idea that it was different than everything we knew about the South at the time. But what is the sound when the Beatles hear Aretha Franklin or they hear any other musician who recorded in Muscle Shoals? What's the sound that really permeates, that makes it distinct?
To me, there's just a groove. There's an incredible, almost minimal groove to it. They don't overplay. I mean, that rhythm section was, I mean, you can hear it on something like Loves Me Like a Rock.
Oh, yeah,
Paul
yeah.
Simon, that's David Hood playing on that with that rhythm section. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they just do the bare minimum. It's kind of like they were listening to James Brown. They were listening to Ray Charles. And there's a real economy to it, an incredible atmosphere and a drive to it. And I think the staple singers, I'll Take You There, if you listen to that song, that was David Hood. Mm-hmm. Been listening to reggae music because Paul Simon had made him listen to reggae music or something. I don't know how it all worked out, but
yeah, it was all at that same time they were learning how to play these different styles, but they were also playing with the singer in mind. They weren't playing with themselves in mind, and that's actually something that I got when we were working with them in the studio, was that I was amazed by the notes that David Hood played and those he didn't play, where it was like he let us and the drummer and the singers kind of just do their thing. And everyone had their place in the studio. Actually, I think that the big thing about Muscle Shoals, too, is that they tend to record live there. And I think that's true for most of all the big sessions and all the big records that have come out. Everyone plays together in a room.
I was a little scared.
Yeah.
Why?
Just to have to do the vocals there, you know, with the drums going on. And it was actually fantastic. It was brilliant.
Yeah, I have to say, I think that's almost all your lead vocals live.
Nearly
record.
All the lead vocals were live, And we do a couple of takes, and then, you know, because of the new digital technology, if there's a bit I didn't like, they just go, hang on, what about this previous version?
And you've a tremendous career in music, but you're used to recording the vocals in different space, not doing it live with the drums in the room.
I've done it live a lot, but it's a different type of music almost. The stuff we do with the Mekons, we've done a lot of, you know, we'll experiment with all sorts of wild ways of making music, but this was actually quite formal, and you know, you're working. I'd never really worked with a producer or session musicians. I'd only worked with people I knew, so this was kind of like high stakes. And it was
what do you have to do as musicians to key in, to tune in, if you will, to a place, to Muscle Shoals. So you get down there, you know that you're going to be recording the music that you already wrote and got ready for this event. What do you have to do in the moment to have that Muscle Shoals feeling come through?
For me, it was just to kind of do my job. You know, nobody said it's about the emotion in the vocals. That's what it's all about. And that, there was me, Bethany, and Tony trying this experiment where we're doing kind of joint lead vocals, which was fabulous. But we were doing it live, and we were all standing right next to each other. So it was really beautiful because it worked. It was a little scary because if it hadn't worked, it would have been, you know, kind of waste of 4 days.
Right, yeah. And, I mean, for me, it was like, because I got to play guitar in the whole session. Like, I played all the main rhythm parts. And so it was kind of like me helping set the tempo with the band and kind of like letting it happen. And just like, if there was a screw up in the take, you know, we just started again. There was no like discussion really about it, except when it got to charts, but that's a whole other story. But
they used the number system down there. So there was a lot of discussions about it's a 1 to a 4, then 1, 4, 5, then it's a 2, a 6.
Yeah.
Then it's a 6 flat. And I'm like, I have no idea.
Chicago, you're like, just turn
and I'm saying
on,
things like, you know, that bit in the middle when it goes a bit shimmery. Could you make that sound more kind of bombastic? Yeah. And they're going, what's he talking about? And Norbert would get on the mic and go like, just don't hit the hi-hat at that point. The 1, 4, 5, 6 dropout, don't hit the hi-hat. Just do a football. And I'm going, what's he talking about?
Yeah,
like,
I got really good at being the translator between everybody just because...
you were in the middle.
Yeah, because I had to, yeah.
We had the faintest idea what was going on.
And I'm just like, oh, so a diamond means a half note, a whole note, you know, rings out through the whole measure. So, like, I got pretty good at talking to everybody and being like, okay, now you got to go back to the flat 3.
Let me ask this. As a musician, and you're professional musicians, and of course, John, you've had such a crazy career, when do you know when the project's done? Are you a tinkerer? Are you the kind of guy who's like, well, almost, especially when you're doing them live, are you constantly in your head saying, let's do it again, let's feel it again?
No, I was happy. A lot of the times I was happy. I mean, the person who would, while we would go into, we'd do like 2 or 3 takes of each song, and we'd go back in the control room, and Norbert would say, that sounded great. Come in, have a listen. And then David Hood would say, while you're playing it back, could I just play it one more time? And then we'd go in the control room and listen, and I would like watch, and David Hood would be like kind of completely dominating the track at that point. So it's like, you know, it just has this incredible, but it's not overbearing, it's not like somebody showing off, right. It's just like a machine where it kind of finally really clicks in. So while we were listening to them back, they were sounding better than they had at the time anyway, and I was kind of, if Norbert said my vocal was all right, I'm gonna believe you, man. You know, you're the producer.
As musicians, do you like the concept of going away to a place and spending 4 days, eat, breathe, sleep?
Yeah, I much prefer that. It's very hard to record in Chicago, especially, you know, when you've got kids and family and stuff like that, and to be able to concentrate fully. So a lot of the times with the Mekons, over the last few years, we've gone to various remote locations in Great Britain. We went with Robbie Folks up to Jura, a Scottish island, where they make very good whiskey, and we made an album there. But strangely enough, we wrote all the songs about the sea and Scottish islands and whiskey. And... the Mekons, last September, we went to the desert, Joshua Tree, and then all the songs and the lyrics appear to be about the desert. It's interesting. Yeah. Site-specific things are kind of interesting. You can get really involved in it very intensely. And the fact we only had 5 days there down in Muscle Shoals, and one day was kind of a day off because Norbert says, well, maybe we won't do anything that day. We might just go to the lake. Okay.
John Langford, John Szymanski in studio. They are two of the 4 Lost Souls. John Langford's 4 Lost Souls. Of course, the album is out now, recorded in Muscle Shoals, northern part of Alabama, in Sheffield, Alabama. All right, we'll take a quick break. When we come back, let's get some live music, and we'll continue the conversation with John Langford and John Szymanski here in The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, John Langford, John Szymanski, talking about the new project that just came out, the album John Langford's 4 Lost Souls. They're in studio, 2 of the guys, Tawny Newsom, Bethany Thomas, not with us tonight, but you guys are going to play live here. What's the track we're going to hear?
Oh, this is called I Thought He Was Dead.
I Thought He Was Dead. John Langford, John Szymanski in studio. Take it away. One, 2, 3.
No, 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 don't turn that dial. You're all in for a big surprise. You're never gonna believe who we've got here. No idea he was still alive. Yeah, I thought he was dead. But he sang Storm on the Ocean. Storm on the Ocean. Moving his old way. It's getting so you can't afford to die. He sang Storm on the Ocean. Storm on the Ocean. Moving his old way. There's $95 or $96 right here in an envelope for you. But don't be putting that overcoat on. We want another number. We want another song. Yet I thought he was dead. But he sang Storm on the Ocean. Storm on the Ocean. Moving his old way. It's getting so you can't afford to die. He sang Storm on the Ocean. Storm on the Ocean. Moving his old way. You see him sitting by the back door, listening to the radio. Long strides down the railroad track. Never on the road, he give anything away. He gave away everything. He might wait till you offer to pay. But he just give it away, give it away. Yet I thought he was dead. He sang Storm on the Ocean. Storm on the Ocean. Moving his old way. It's getting so you can't afford to die. He sang Storm on the Ocean. Storm on the Ocean, moving his old way.
Worked out.
Yeah. Great music in studio, John Langford, John Szymanski. That was I Thought He Was Dead off the new album, John Langford's Four Lost Souls. John Langford, John Szymanski in studio talking about their experience of recording this album in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. Amazing experience, as we talked about in the first half. As you look at it now, you're back, the album's out. You've had the opportunity to record at Nuthouse Studios in Sheffield, Alabama. Has it changed you guys as musicians? Do you think differently about your work now that you had a chance to almost travel to the Mecca?
It has, actually. You know, that's the first album I've ever done where I didn't play guitar, I think. Or maybe the first Mekons album where I played drums. But this is the first time I haven't. And I really like the idea of just being in there, being the singer, but singing live at the same time as the drums went down. It was very exciting. And it felt very much like a moment. Performance.
It seems to me, John, that you spend a lot of your time, whether it be, we just mentioned the places you've gone just in the last couple of years, whether it be Joshua Tree or other places, that it is about the experience of recording. It is about where you go and it had an influence on how you record and how the music sounds. Is that part of your life's journey at this point to say, hey, I'm going to seek out these places to record music?
I think it's good to keep... put yourself off balance a bit. I think it's really, if you have a studio you like and you've done something really good there that's been successful, I don't recommend going back there. you know. It's better to brunch out and, you know, challenge yourself in a different way. I mean, I think that's the model for a lot of bands, is you get a sort of sound and you craft that sound, you perfect it, and you kind of whittle it down, and it becomes more streamlined. And the Mekons has always been the opposite. And I think in particularly in more recent years, we like the challenge, we like the idea of traveling, we like new experiences. It's more inspiring. So going to Muscle Shoals was pretty wild, in the sense that it was like going back into a situation I'd almost avoided in the past, like working with a producer, working with session musicians. It was just so special because the people involved, we really respected them so much. And the fact that they would even bother to spend any time with us is...
Right.
It's kind of a, how about you, John?
For me, because I spend a lot of time recording and playing with different people, like this was such an amazing experience that I just learned so much. And I got to embrace situations that were handed to me and just being like, okay, now you're going to make this record and you're going to play. Yeah, and you're going to be in the same room as people that you've admired for years. You're going to make the best record you can. And when you come out of that, you're just like, well, I can't not do awesome work anymore. I have to just keep going and keep, right. You know.
The music's beautiful because it's kind of a leveler as well. Because, you know, I mean, I remember when the first time I played with Norbert at the Country Music Hall of Fame, he dropped a big clam at the end of this song, and he apologized to me afterwards. And I'm like, "What?" It's kind of ironic that Norbert Putnam's apologizing to me for making a mistake. I mean, my whole life's a mistake compared to his, you know.
Now that you've done it, and you got a chance to go down to Muscle Shoals, when you think about it and the experience that you went through and just ask the question how it changed you, is Muscle Shoals the same to you? Now that you've experienced it in the way that you recorded music, where all this music was recorded, does it still have the same shine on the top of the hill that it did for all those years?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I would say that a lot of the guys down there didn't like that movie very much.
The movie didn't really
present it as it maybe should have been presented. It was kind of a one-sided story. I think it's a complicated place, and I think between that and Stax in Memphis, and you've got a really, really rich history, and there's records that came out of Muscle Shoals and things I find out about reading about it now, you know, that I didn't know about when we were there. So it's we actually get to play at the Stax Museum on this tour, which is wonderful, with
That's
Norbert
great.
And we're going to have kind of talk about Norbert's career a little bit, and then he's going to play bass with us. So
how great is that?
It's amazing.
It's cool.
And to be able to play this kind of music, to put this together in honor of Muscle Shoals and to bring a soulful record on tour to play Stax Museum. I've loved your career, John, in the way that you've been able to go from punk to country to rock and roll to all that stuff and soul as well. But now that you've had the opportunity to kind of do the soul record.
I think Bethany and Tony definitely, I sort of handed them the songs and said, is there anything in here that we can kind of make sense with at Muscle Shoals?
Does this music change the John Langford sound moving forward? Do you see yourself?
I wrote in a different way for this. And I wrote, specifically. I mean, I think all records are kind of concept records, but this was definitely about music making. And, lyrically, it's about the history of that music as well. And a lot of the music that comes out of the South, this the kind of collision between the politics and the music. I mean, a lot of my stuff is like that, but this is in a different kind of venue, if you like, or context. So,
do you like the history part of the music in the way that a lot of you listen to the music and even talked about being at the Country Music Hall of Fame and looking into the archives and almost doing research to create a record that would be a Muscle Shoals record? Well, do you see yourself moving forward in a way that you're half musician, half music historian?
Oh, I'm already half musician, half visual artist, so I don't know if there's room to be anything.
The third, put a third.
Yeah, it's just the third half. Yeah.
I just want to be a rock singer, Justin. You know, that's what it said on my work visa once. I went to Norway and they gave me this visa and it said rock singer on it. Oh, God, that's so much better than artist stroke musician, like it says on my tax forms. I'd love to, when I meet my wife's family, and say, well, what does your husband do? Oh, hi, I'm a rock singer.
Singer.
It's so much better. Yeah.
Better than rock historian?
Yeah, I don't know. But I've always kind of fed on those stories of musicians. I've always enjoyed the history. And I've always enjoyed me having very lucky in my encounters with people that I've admired, so that it's been inspiring.
John, how about you? As a session musician here in Chicago who's worked with a lot of different people, and I see you all the time in the studio, Did it change your approach that you were able to have this historical experience?
Oh, yeah, just like learning how to play with others that much better, you know, and like learning to listen and kind of like, I've learned so much in the last year just playing with John and playing with Bethany and Tawny, and just taking that and then moving forward and then using that wisdom to kind of fuel new stuff is really exciting to me, and I'm excited, you know.
John Szymanski and, of course, John Langford in studio. John Langford's Four Lost Souls is out now. Thanks for coming in and talking about the record. Appreciate it.
Brilliant. Thanks.
Thanks.
If I wasn't already 7.5 to 8.5 hours in the car, I would have just gone right past Nashville. I'm 24, just right into Muscle Shoals, right? When I went to Nashville last weekend, I would have just done that. But then I completely forgot. And at the same time, it's 8 hours. Like, I was like, I just want, can we please get to the Doubletree, wherever we're staying? I didn't have time to soak in the roots of R&B music and American history. No, I need to get to that buffet. I had to check in, see what kind of soap they had going on. This hotel, it was a nice hotel down in Nashville. It was a newer one. And my 10-year-old son was like, this is the best hotel I've ever stayed at. And I was like, because they dressed it up real nice. So it was like a really, like real bright blue wall, blue, like a bright yellow wall. Then like some cool furniture in the lobby. You know, it's like, all right, you walk in there, you're like, yeah, all right, I know what's up. But it's so funny because I was like, this is the best ever stayed at. Wow, you really, really into this hotel? I was like, because I like that. But yeah, some really great, got some coffee down there. But they had like, they everything was painted, it was kind of new, it was like a new Hilton property. And they had soap. But they had it attached to the wall. It was almost like it was the kind of thing like in the shower that you would just pump. But it was attached to the wall like to fill that. There wasn't, you didn't get individualized soaps. No individualized lotion.
Hmm. Couldn't take any of that stuff home with you?
Yeah, I guess. And the thing I thought was hilarious is I right away went to, man, it must be a bummer to fill that. Like if you're the person who worked in a hotel, you'd be like, oh, man, I got to fill the soap in room 14. Like,
yeah.
Like, but it's like, how do you get it in there? Yeah. How do you do that?
I think that's probably the least of their concerns. Anybody that works in a hotel, the hotel industry.
They're just like, I'm so worried every night. I'm worried about the soap. Yeah, it was funny how flashy the whole place was. All these flashy, cool things. Like there was no closet. They used hooks on the wall to be like, you hang your stuff up right here.
Oh, that's how
real
you do
nice.
It now, yeah.
So cool. It's like living in Brooklyn. You ever heard of New York City? It's like that. Brightly colored walls with cool hooks on the wall, and we got lotion out of a dispenser. Yeah.
Whenever I don't have much hair, but whenever I travel and I stay in a hotel, my hair is very well conditioned because I go nuts on the conditioner.
So true. I don't have any hair. I don't have any hair. I'm completely bald, and I do the same thing. I'm like, let's see what this smell is going to give me. This is going to be a new smell for me. Walk out of that place like, what's that? What's that lavender breeze? Like, well, you know, there's a little condition on this bald head. That's so true. You just load up on it. I'm going to hit this conditioner. Win in Rome, right? It's so true. All right, coming up, Patty Vasquez is going to join, and she is going to take over. She's not going to join. She can take over her own show pretty late with Patty Vasquez, which starts at 11. We will be back on Monday. We're off tomorrow. Hawks game tomorrow night. Monday night. We got a good show. Well, you know, Adam will be on. Talk about the Saints-Bears.
Bears victory.
The Bears victory to get to 500. It's amazing that the New Orleans Saints are an 8.5-point favorite in that game. I get that the Saints are a good, I guess, a good team. They beat a couple of good teams. They lost to. But it's amazing to me that they are favored in such a way. I mean, I guess at the end of the day, oh, yeah, our offense only threw four passes. Because you're right when you're like, oh, yeah, what was Trubisky's stats last week? 4 of 7. I guess if you're an odds maker, you look at those stats, right? Even though they won the game, you're like, yeah. Tonight, the Jay Cutler-less Miami Dolphins got beat 40-0, and towards the end of the game, a cat ran out onto the field.
Yeah. I saw Dead's been tweeting said that the cat gained more yards than the Dolphins all game because the cat, like, sprinted from, you know, like the 20 to midfield.
So Cutler's out, huh?
Yeah,
got a couple of broken ribs. Didn't see that coming. I don't know. I mean, if you're listening in Miami, hate your football team yet? Get used to it. That's what's going to happen. First it starts with, I guess he's okay. Then he'll do a game where you're like, he's not okay. And then, oh, he got hurt. Oh, our team is in disarray. Chaos everywhere. And that is the Jay Cutler experience. Enjoy it. We're 3-4. Are they 4-3? 4-4? The Dolphins are good, I guess. Whatever. All right, this is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn.